There's just a couple of quick announcements. Just a reminder that each of the bills that we have today are going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I know that there's some other activities and constituent meetings people have, so we'll try to go through these as quickly as we can, but I am aware of those scheduling conflicts. In addition, there was some issues with duplicating, so we're going to start off with House File 3988. Representative Lehman, rather than formally move it for consideration, we're going to have you discuss the bill as you'll be amending it, and then we'll distribute the amendment to members of the committee as soon as we get it. So Representative Lehman, you're up first, House File 3988, and again, we will discuss the if you could just present the bill as it will be amended, and then we'll distribute that amendment as soon as we get the updated duplication records. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Yes, the bill before you, 3988, has a DE1 amendment, which you will be receiving shortly. And so is it proper for me to introduce that for a vote right now, or would you like me just to speak to it?
Representative Lehman, I think the better thing would be to speak to the bill as it will be amended, and then when people get that written confirmation, they can review that. So I'll just go through your public testimony and discuss the bill as it will be amended.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I am pleased to be here today, and with me is Rolf Weberg, the director of the Natural Resource Research Institute, and Eric Singas, who is the initiative director for wood products, materials, and bioeconomy with the Natural Resource Research Institute. And just so we don't all trip over our tongues, I'm going to say NRRI is the acronym for the institute. Well, the NRRI is connected with the University of Minnesota Duluth campus, but they are their own nonprofit. Their mission is to look at our natural resources, our wood products, our minerals, our water, and look at the next best use for those resources in a sustainable manner. And so today the amendment that you're going to see before you is a request to help them continue in that work with an appropriation of $600,000. It's a one-time appropriation in 2019 from the renewable development account. And just quickly, I would like to say that, where my district is northeastern Minnesota, and as you know, we are a natural resource based region, and we're currently facing some issues with our wood products industries. Our paper company is closing plants. Our Potlatch and Ainsworth and others have closed earlier on in the century. So we are very interested in looking at the next best use for our wood products, not just for, obviously, northeastern Minnesota, but for the greater state of Minnesota and the surrounding region. And NRRI is poised to be that institute to do the research to help us identify the next use. So with that, I'd like to introduce Rolf Weberg to talk a little bit more about the details of the bill. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Lehman, Chairman Garofalo, and committee. My name is Rolf Weberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Natural Resources Research Institute as part of the University of Minnesota. And we are an applied research institute that works across the state and across the system to drive solutions for the state. Our mission is to deliver, which is a word we focus on a lot, research solutions which are comprehensive in nature to balance our economy, our resources, our environment for resilient communities, and that focus on resilient communities means jobs every day, every year, year-round. When we look at our economy here in Minnesota, we look at it and see that it's really made up of a nexus of energy, water, and materials. Materials are a big part of what Minnesota produces in this economy. When we look at our innovation focus, we focus on three things. One is to reduce waste, which is about increasing competitiveness. Somebody's waste is somebody else's raw material. Product diversification and higher value, which drives resilience and maximum benefit to the state, and embracing sustainability as a competitive advantage. We're focusing on the economy of the future for Minnesota. Our role in doing this is to seek out unique and differentiating technologies, translate those to application, and demonstrate on a pilot level to de-risk and focus on Minnesota opportunities to attract investment here in the state. For the past several years, NRI has worked with several external funding sources and organizations to leverage state support to build a renewable energy laboratory at our Coleraine facility in Coleraine, Minnesota. This asset now is able to transform woody biomass waste at the rate of about 6 tons a day into solid biofuels that we just turned on earlier this year. That's extending into several other processes, giving us an opportunity to look at how do we take biomass in general, focusing on woody biomass right now, and turn those into higher value products, whether they be energy products or material products. Again, focusing on reducing waste, diversifying to higher value. Recently, and I'll pass these around, although these don't look impressive by themselves, this is world-leading technology that has allowed a great deal of attention globally to come to NRI and look for opportunities to work with us to understand how to transform biomass into a pellet, a high-carbon pellet. These have about the same energy content as a piece of coal, and they can be stored outside, which is a significant advantage over anything else that's been done globally. This is just the first stage. This is not an end at all, and my colleague will be telling you about what we want to do with this money to take this to the next level, both from an energy point of view as well as to a material point of view that locks up the carbon for much longer time. There are two key areas of focus for the demonstration efforts here, focused on higher value materials and then also on the biogas. But this is an initial ask to support specific projects that we have engagement from right now from industries around the world that we want to keep the focus on and keep the momentum. Very important to keep momentum. Stopping takes Minnesota out of the game, and we can't afford that. We will be back next year. We're going to be working this next year with industry partners, NGOs, agencies to come back with a much more comprehensive approach for what do we do with biomass and other energy sources in the state of Minnesota to be able to put that in front of you at that time. At this right now, I'd like to introduce Dr. Eric Singsas. He's our director of NRI's Wood Products and Bioeconomy Research Effort, and he'll provide a more detailed description of these two specific areas we'd like to have support so we can continue this important work for the state. Dr. Kingsoss.
Welcome to the committee. And before you begin, I have to tell you, no disrespect, but these just don't taste that good. I'm sorry. on a side note, I want to thank Representative Moran. She's passing around some cupcakes for everyone to have a little treat on. On a totally unrelated note, when the omnibus bill comes out next week, all of Representative Moran's provisions will be in the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Dr. Eric Singsas from the Natural Resources Research Institute. Thank you, Dr. Weberg, Chairman Garofalo, and Representative Lehman. I wanted to elaborate a little bit on the two technology areas that we have called out in this bill for investment. The first is the higher value fuels from biomass. The biomass briquettes that you have going around, despite their flavor shortcomings, are a truly advanced fuel from biomass. And as Dr. Weber mentioned, there are a number of technology partners looking to implement those as they exist. But that's not the end of the line with that technology. This technology demonstration works with our existing technology demonstration works with our existing energy infrastructure with no modifications of that that infrastructure. The next generation technology will take these processed materials to higher value products, such as, but not limited to, renewable jet fuel, renewable diesel, and bio-based chemicals. These are higher value products than a solid biofuel themselves, and they're products that industry is asking for. We have Minnesota companies who are looking for us to help invest in their technologies and taking their designs and laboratory-based experiments to the next scale for a demonstration that is relevant and which will lower the commercial risk for private investors to make these commercial reality. The second area that we're looking to invest in is advanced biogas infrastructure. Several partners from throughout the state and the university system are looking to expand our waste-to-energy generation capabilities all across the state. This includes sewage waste, food waste, and manure from agricultural operations. We learned from our interactions with our colleagues in North Rhine-Westphalia in Germany that there are technology platforms to make this process both much cleaner as well as more efficient. We will invest in demonstration and advanced biogas production, which will also serve as a platform for developments of new methods for treatments of effluents such as sulfur dioxide, phosphate, and nitrogen waste to convert those into valuable products, valuable fertilizers, and so forth. And we'll complete completely reuse any material that is output from that process. So we envision these demonstrations will encourage statewide deployment of next-generation digester technology.
So in closing, we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. As Representative Lehman outlined, we have four paper plants across the state that are challenged. Each of them represents $1.3 billion of investment with 700 jobs associated with directly and indirectly. It's a very, very expensive front end. If we can figure out what to do on the back end to make those more applicable and bring them into the next generation of our economy, that's what we're really focusing on. But what we do is applicable across the state. Learning how to do this with woody biomass is a direct line, as Dr. Singsas pointed out, to talking about biomass issues, whether it happens to be invasive species, agricultural waste, municipal waste, or in this case, woody biomass. So with that, we'll close. Thank you for your support, and we won't answer any questions, Chairman.
Thank you. First of all, members, you do have the DE1 amendment now in your packet. Chair will move, Representative Lehman will move House File 3988 for possible inclusion in a later bill, and she'll also move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form she would like. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Lehman, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and big thank you to our staff at the NRI. I know we've made investments in the past and think that our government should be doing that. We wouldn't have taconite today on the Iron Range without significant resources being put in to make sure that we develop the skills and science necessary to move things into the next generation of the technologies we need to be successful in this changing global economy. Just like to thank you as well, Representative Lehman, for getting this bill put together, and I know we're working on another one for some other great research that they're doing. And so keep up the good work, and we'll look forward to seeing what comes out as the finished products and know that it'll benefit the state when we get to license some of these products out and see a return on investment.
Representative Wagenius.
To the testifiers, would you just expand just a little bit more on what you're doing with sewage waste?
Testifiers?
Yeah, thank you for your question. There's a family of technologies referred to as biodigester or biogas production. Sewage waste and all these wastes, naturally, if you leave them untreated, they produce methane, and the methane escapes into the atmosphere. Biodigester technology takes advantage of this natural process. It does it in an enclosed space that allows for the capture of the methane. And then when done with these advanced technologies, you can make a clean methane product that can be burned in a generator to generate electricity. It can be bottled up and put into transportation, so any natural gas, compressed natural gas fueled vehicle can run off of this biogas technology.
Any additional questions or comments? Representative Wagenius.
Yes. When you say you're converting it to clean, what do you mean by that?
Excellent question. So when you do this, there are a number of this technology has been around for centuries, but with the advanced technologies and the differentiating technologies that we want to bring, number one, remove sulfur dioxide from this, so there is no concern about air pollution with this. We also are working to develop. We are working on technologies to remove and concentrate phosphate and nitrate that comes in the effluent out of that, so that it it can be recaptured and used as a fertilizer product. And all of the products that come out, there's a liquid and a solid waste that come out the other end at the final end of the process. And there are technologies to utilize those 100%, either for an energy or a fertilizer process, so that there's no waste from this process.
Yeah. Just to give a real-life example, a couple of real-life examples, in current biogas, one of the dairies in northwestern Minnesota is generating lots and lots of biogas as part of their perceived product and managing their manure waste. Because the gas wasn't clean of the sulfur dioxides, when it burned in the engines, it created sulfuric acid, which, of course, is deleterious to an engine. They last a couple of weeks, and they're over. Because they couldn't get to that point of clean biogas or clean methane, the entire operation was shut down at a significant loss. When we look at larger waste treatment plants, the sulfur is an issue, how to get rid of it. It, as Dr. Singsas pointed out, if you can extract it in the form that's actually useful, knowing full well that our agricultural fields in southern Minnesota are sulfur depleted, and sulfur zero, which can be a product of this, could be, instead of a waste material, become something that's actually useful. So a couple examples to give you an idea of how these pieces interlock and integrate into a solution. Does that help?
Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, well, we've had...
Or Representative McGinnis, I'm sorry.
We've invested a lot of money in digester and hasn't gone anyplace. So that's where I was following up. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative O'Neill, you get the last question, and then we'll go to the closing statement.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious about the energy conversion of these carbon pellets. So how much energy does it take to produce the carbon pellet? And you said it's similar to coal, and so what energy value do you get back out of it?
So the test first?
Yes, thank you for your question again. The best data we have is that is published comes from out of study from Europe, and the carbon reductions are between 80 and 87% for these products. We are right now engaged with researchers out of North Carolina State University who are doing a similar study for this process with Minnesota wood. The reason that we do these kind of demonstrations is so that we can collect the necessary data that allow us to answer those questions.
And one other comment, when we look at these options that we have in front of us, realizing this is the first step, what we're really talking about is building a portfolio of these options so that we can understand at what point, where is it carbon neutral, where is it carbon positive, where is it carbon negative, because if we build this first example that you have in front of you today, that is really a pre-processing step that happens to have a lot of energy in it that can be burned. If you put that in your charcoal grill, it may melt it. It's very high energy content. It's just as if you put coal in your charcoal grill, but it's not the end result. And one of the reasons we're building this is to do the life cycle analysis that's necessary to build that level of understanding, which is very important. I agree.
Representative Lehman, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just, reiterate that in Minnesota we have a tremendous infrastructure in our logging industry, in our paper industry, in our mills. We don't want to lose that infrastructure. And so the sooner we can find higher value-added products to maintain and utilize that infrastructure, the better. So I thank you for hearing this, and I encourage your support. Thank you.
With that, Representative Lehman renews her motion to have House File 3988 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Lehman.
Thank you.
Representative Barr-R. And if Mr. Hamilton wants to come forward. Representative Scott moves House File 3810 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Bar R, you don't. I have to say Bar R because Bar C is here too. You don't have any amendments to your bill, do you?
No amendments, okay. Thank you.
Representative Barr, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3810 is a bill that would appropriate $1 million to Project Build Minnesota in 2019. For those of you that don't know what Project Build is, it's a statewide construction workforce enhancements program. And its goal, simply put, is to spread the word about construction careers in Minnesota. On a personal note, I just want to tell you I'm really excited to be carrying this bill. I have a passion for workforce development. In my own business, I work with a lot of small to mid-sized companies. Right now, I'm working with a drilling company and a manufacturer. And one of the biggest challenges that I hear all the time when I work with their executives is that they have a hard time attracting people into the profession. So I am delighted to be carrying that. Also, on a personal note, I have three brothers, and growing up, I was the bookworm and the studious one and went on to college, and all three of my brothers went into different areas of the trades, and my oldest brother currently teaches after working as a mason, owning a business. He teaches at a maximum security prison. He teaches inmates skills so that when they leave, they can go out and have a viable trade. And he just got his college degree so that if he chooses to, he can also teach in the schools. So with that, I will defer to questions or turn it over to my testifiers.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Dave Siegel, and I'm the executive director of Housing First Minnesota and a founding board member of Project Build Minnesota. Housing First Minnesota represents about 1,200 construction firms. These are home builders, remodelers, trade partners, suppliers across Minnesota. We also have a charitable arm called the BATSE Housing First Minnesota Foundation, which provides scholarships for young people pursuing careers in the trades. Our scholarship committee met on Tuesday of this week to give out our scholarships. I just want to tell you about one applicant. His name is Juan. He's 35 years old, and he's pursuing a degree in HVAC, wants to go become an HVAC technician. In his essay, he said, if the 18-year-old Juan would have known about the value of technical training that the 35-year-old Juan now knows, his life would be quite different. And when we called him to present the scholarship to him, he literally broke down in tears on the phone. We need to reinvent how today's youth and those who guide today's youth view the construction industry. As Juan said, if he'd only known. This is why we've come together to form Project Build Minnesota. We're a collaboration of many construction-related associations dedicated to bringing greater awareness to young men and women of all races and all ethnic backgrounds about the tremendous career path in the construction industry. And beyond that, we also have to educate and inform those who help those young people make their decisions. These are the parents, the teachers, the counselors, the coaches, and the administrators. So Project Build Minnesota is a powerful initiative to change the perception of our industry, increase the awareness of career opportunities and the career path in our industry through a multi-channel, multi-year public awareness campaign with the simple goal, as the representative stated, of bringing more young people into the field. We know there are other efforts in this space. Many of the associations that are part of Project Build Minnesota themselves are doing things in this space, and we support them all and we complement them all. This cannot be done alone. It is a massive effort, and that's why we've all come together. But you should know that Project Build Minnesota, in influencing the way Minnesotans feel about careers in construction, will then help all of those efforts. Just give you a quick assessment of why it's important. DEED estimates that we're going to need 20,000 new workers in construction in the next decade. For housing alone, which is my area, state agencies are acknowledging that the workforce shortage is actually holding back Minnesota's economy. Through about this image enhancement, recruiting individuals into our field, the jobs are there, the training is there. The issue is we just do not have enough young people who see this as a viable career opportunity. Most folks don't realize how much you can actually make in the construction field and that it provides a great career path. So that's why I'm here today, Project Build Minnesota is seeking state workforce funding to assist our organization in its mission to educate and inform Minnesota's young adults and their parents, teachers, coaches, counselors, and administrators that construction is a noble and exciting way to build communities and shape people's lives. There was a time in our society when artisanship, craftsmanship were valued, and we need to return and restore our society to that place. So, Mr. Chair and representatives, I ask for your support for Project Build Minnesota. I'd like to turn this over to my colleague, Lowell Pratt, who is a home builder who can share a little bit of his perspective, if I might.
As David said, my name is Lowell Pratt, and I've been in the residential home building business for over 45 years. We employ all of our own carpenters, so we're a little uniquely positioned to see these young people. Over the course of the last 45 years, there's been a great sea change. 45 years ago, when we first got into this business, young people really viewed a career in the construction trades as an opportunity. That doesn't exist today. Our educational, our secondary education has led young people to believe that the only career path is one through college. And quite frankly, that's what they've been trained for. A lot of the career and tech programs have been taken out of the schools, and so our young people don't even view this as an opportunity. And that's a disservice to them. You know, we can talk about the labor shortage, and every industry is experiencing it, but I think ours is kind of acutely experiencing it. But the real issue here is, are we serving our young people by maybe misleading them or creating the perception that the only path to success is with a four-year college degree? They're missing the opportunity to have a fulfilling, creative career in the trades where they can actually earn as good a living as someone with a four-year college degree. So we owe it to them, I think, to let them know that there is another career path that can be just as fulfilling and just as meaningful as something that, might require a four-year college degree. That's my message, I guess. And we ask you to support our bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Barr, do you have any other invited testifiers? Oh, Mr. Hamilton, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ryan Hamilton. I'm a lobbyist with the Minnesota Realtors. In case anyone's wondering why do realtors care about a construction jobs bill, well, it's because of back to the inventory problem that I presented last month on another housing bill. We need more houses to be built out in our market. We also need more trade folks to help remodel and refurbish the existing housing stock. So, again, I mentioned last month I came before you with some housing data, and that was the February data or the March data. The numbers have gotten worse. Included in your packets, I believe, is a press release that we sent out earlier this week. The highlights there are that Hennepin and Ramsey counties are at 1.6 and 1.0 months supply of inventory, respectively. And again, a healthy marketplace in an urban county such as those would be 4.5 to 5.5 months of supply. For the 7-county Twin Cities region, our month supply is down to 1.5. Again, healthy is in the 4, 4.5, 5. And it's not just an urban Twin Cities inner city problem. Outstate, the numbers are just as bleak. Southeast Minnesota, they're down to 2.1 months supply of inventory. And so it's just simple supply and demand. And when we're playing musical chairs with our houses, and that's causing our median sales prices to go up. I think that's included in your pack as well, our 7-county region market update. If you look at the line graph, historical median sales price, again, just a consistent trend up. We're up to $265,000 as a median sales price. And just when you're back home in your districts, ask your neighbors and constituents about if they've tried to do a remodeling project on their home and how hard it is to find an electrician or a plumber. And, again, supply and demand, when those folks know that they're in short supply, they can raise their bids. So, again, this all relates to housing affordability in terms of just inventory and having folks out there to help create the housing stock. Thank you. And thanks, Representative Barr, for bringing this proposal forward.
Representative Barr, do you have any other invited testifiers?
Yes. I think we have two more, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors. We have over 350 contractor and construction-related firms throughout the state who do commercial and industrial work. These include multifamily housing, energy and industrial projects, retail establishments, medical facilities, and so much more. ABC supports House File 3810, and thanks Representative Barr and Chair Garofalo for being authors on this bill and for hearing it today. I won't repeat too much what was said related to workforce, but in the commercial and industrial fields as well, just like in residential, the labor shortage is affecting the industry. And so we hear countless times that contractors are having to either turn down work or projects getting delayed or extended simply because there aren't enough crews and folks to go around to do this work. Minnesota contractors are hungry to build. They're ready to hire and grow the businesses and provide more high-paying and rewarding jobs. And so I'd like to turn testimony over to Jessica Friesman, who works at a commercial general contractor in the state, and to hear from her about what Project Build means for her in her industry.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Friesman, and I am a project manager for Shingleby Builders. We are a merit shop commercial general contractor located out in Loretto, Minnesota. I'm here in support of Project Build Minnesota on behalf of myself and my company. We are currently experiencing industry-wide a severe labor shortage and a lot of retiring tradesmen. So how does this impact our work? And it really impacts our owners. It impacts the public owners and the private owners. They're spending more money, and the schedules are becoming prolonged as well. That's not what any owner wants. They don't want to spend more money, and they don't want to find out that their job's going to take an extra month or 2 months. So examples of this. To compensate for labor shortages out at the Alamo Cinema Draft House in Woodbury, Minnesota, we had to start masonry 2 months early. This means that we're starting masonry in January. January includes winter conditions. 2 months worth of winter conditions.
And for the record, April includes winter conditions.
It does. This weekend, it definitely does, doesn't it?
Sorry. This is just testimony.
And the longer people talk, the longer we're going to get caught in the stuff.
I'll make it quick so we can all get out of here.
Just a subtle hint, folks.
To the testimony.
Okay. So obviously winter conditions are something that owners had to experience on that job, and winter conditions can be very, very pricey. In addition to that, we had the Courtyard by Marriott, which is located in St. Louis Park. This almost didn't open in time for the Super Bowl purely as a result of not having enough tradesmen to complete the carpentry required for this building. We're also having the exact same issue out at the Residence Inn in Eagan. We're running out of carpenters and we're running out of drywallers. These are three jobs that have had issues just in 2018. Yesterday, I turned 30. Thinking I'm going to have a great day, 20 minutes later, I got a phone call saying that one of my projects is impacted as a result of carpenters not being available. Obviously, there was a whirlwind of issues after that. 30 turned out to be a pretty good celebration, though. So my schedules were impacted due to my framers, and I experienced that, and I dealt with it. But as a young female in this industry, I face a lot of obstacles. There's obviously the general, you know, no emotion in construction from women, and heaven forbid my girly side show. But I'm young. Therefore, I'm also assumed to not know anything. What I do know with absolute certainty, though, is that we need a drastic change. We need a paradigm shift. And we need to convince people to go into the trades. We have a gap in the industry, which I observe every day in my jobs and in my own company. Many people are retiring over the next few years, and young people like myself and current high school students have to fill those gaps. As someone who is young and still learning every day, it is imperative that this paradigm shift occur immediately. It's not just the labor gap that is growing, but it's the knowledge gap that's also associated with it. Once we lose our experienced tradesmen to retirement, it will be more difficult to train the upcoming people that are going to be replacing them. So I leave you with this. As more and more and more people retire every single day, in this industry and less tradesmen are going in every single day, I wonder who's going to build our schools, our offices, and our roads. As a board member of Project Build Minnesota and as a young woman in construction and as a business professional, both myself and my company, Shingleby Builders, strongly support this bill and ask that you guys do as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member comments and questions. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Dabney, is there anyone else besides Representative Dabney? It's Representative Dabney, and then Representative Barr, you'll get the last word.
So I get all the time.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly agree with the diagnosis. And I apologize, I stepped out of the room for a little bit, so I may have missed this, but $1 million is an awfully expensive website. What are the objectives? What are the measures? How are you going to know that this was a good use of the state's taxpayers' large amount of money?
Mr. Siegel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's a great question. Let me first say that many of the associations, all of the associations that have supported Project Build Minnesota have asked the same question. These are board members of organizations that have fiduciary obligations to the members of those organizations. And so we had to present our plan to those boards of directors, and I will say all of those boards of directors have signed on and supported Project Build Minnesota. So I just want you to know that there are many sets of eyes on us, and we welcome that because we're confident that we can provide some success. Also, undoubtedly, these dollars will be issued through a state agency, probably DEED, and DEED will have some specific requirements about what they expect to see from us, and we're eager to have that conversation with DEED because we know we can set some measurables there. More specifically to what you're saying, I would say there's two in general. There's a public awareness campaign. If you were to go out today and buy a billboard, TV, radio, digital, whatever it is you're looking at in terms of awareness, the measurement really today is cost per thousand or eyeballs. It's exposure. It's impressions. And so the first thing we'll be able to tell you is what kind of impressions have we generated through all of the channels, which includes mass media channels, it includes visits to schools, it includes exhibiting at school boards, associations, and various other conferences, it includes being at things like county fairs. We have an entire plan developed in terms of how we're going to expose young people and their parents and counselors and teachers and advisors to the construction career opportunities. So I'd say number one is impressions. And then secondly, we're not the first state to do this. There are about five or six states that have done something like this. Several of them, most of them actually with state funding as we're requesting from you. And the best one I can give you is Alabama started this about 8 years ago. They've seen a 24% increase in technical college and technical training enrollment increases. So that 24% increase is pretty significant, quite significant. And we're fairly confident, well, we are confident that we'll be able to do something similar, that we'll be able to demonstrate for you increases in enrollment in technical training programs and technical college. So I guess that'd be my answer in terms of measurability.
Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the total budget for the project?
Mr. Siegel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to date, we've raised private funds of about $250,000. And we intend to continue to fundraise privately because that's the money we're going to use for the infrastructure of Project Build Minnesota. We are 501c3. We launched officially on January 1st. We've spent the last 2 years building out our base and our foundation, our infrastructure. So we're a formal organization, board of directors. We've got some money in the bank to launch this marketing campaign and awareness campaign initially, but the rocket fuel that you could provide would get us into the marketplace much more rapidly and much more expansively. And as you've heard, we have a need that's immediate and long-term. So that's the dollars that we've raised today, and we intend to continue to do that because we obviously the infrastructure needs to be paid for by the industry. What we will then use state dollars for is strictly the outreach and the information and the awareness campaign.
Representative Danny.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Thank you, Representative Barr. Mr. Chair, there's nothing wrong with outreach. There's certainly a need to make more kids and sometimes the parents aware that the trades, broadly defined, are important, needed, viable, and may just be the right fit for your kid. What this doesn't answer, however, is you get the kid interested, and we've got a real shortage of career technical education teachers in the state. So I'm interested, but I've got no place to go. And there seems to be maybe a lack of coordination around these efforts. They're good efforts, but if they're not coordinated, we spend $1 million getting kids interested and not having any place for them to go. Perhaps some of this $1 million might be best used figuring out which of the retiring tradespeople would be a good choice to become a career technical education teacher and share their experience. Not all of them are good, would be good at that, but not all. Present company excluded, Representative Mahoney. So it's a piece of the puzzle, but I wonder about coordination. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, the last question.
I just had to, I don't know if Representative Barr has ever tracked down what the non-merit shops spend out of their own pockets, but it's upwards of $50 million. If you're looking for carpenters, right down the street, there is a huge facility that does training for carpenters, what is it, maybe 2 miles from here, all paid for with no state dollars. They do a marketing campaign. I know my local, Pipe Fitters, which has a training facility just less than four miles from here, does a marketing campaign. We've never come to the government for money. So we take care of our own. We're happy to bring anybody in. We have expanded the breadth of people that are in our locals. This just looks like somebody looking for money when they don't want to spend their own money.
Representative Barr, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I would say that this bill really is looking to create general awareness. It's to increase the pool overall. Personally, I'm looking to get kids into the trades, into the construction industry. I don't care if it's private sector or union. I just think that this is a smart investment at a very critical juncture in time where we have spent millions of dollars through the schools sending kids to college. Some of these kids go to college. They leave after a year or two with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt and no career. And I think it's because some of these kids want to work with their hands and they have other gifts that we're not tapping into. And I think this bill would help us to create that awareness and get kids into trades, just like my brother, who has had just an amazing career through the trades and at a really critical time where we have master craftsmen retiring, and we need to get these young folks into the career. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would respectfully ask for your support of this bill.
With that, Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 3810 laid over for possible, as amended, no, was not amended, laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Barr. Thank you to our testifiers. Representative Anderson. And Representative Anderson, is the A180756 amendment yours? So Representative Anderson moved the A180756 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, two-year bill as amended.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members, and I have a long ways to get home, too. So anyway, what this bill does is attempt to substantially reduce the cost of compliance with the Alexandria Lakes Sanitary District in meeting their wastewater standard levels. And to me, the bill as amended offers a couple of different pathways to do it. And I think it's a very good, remarkable coming together of the folks of the district and also the MPCA. They worked very hard to come up with this, what I call a compromise, and have some folks to explain it to you and to tell you what the bill does, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Mr. Chair, Daniel Marks. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Flaherty and Hood, and I represent the Alexandria Lake Area Sanitary District. And I apologize, district representatives were hoping to be here, but they were concerned about the weather, as I know all of you are, and so I will be brief as well. So the focus of this bill, and it, as Representative Anderson said, it really represents a collaborative effort with the PCA is to implement a creative solution within the parameters of state and federal law to allow the district to achieve water quality standards in Lake Winona, where its wastewater treatment plant discharges to, and some of the downstream lakes, while saving the state, or potentially saving the state and local residents, millions of dollars. So right now, as is detailed in the handout, the district is looking at an infrastructure upgrade of about $14 million to comply with a phosphorus limit. And for the last several years, the district has been in substantial compliance. The final compliance deadline is 2021, and they can meet it, you know, the majority of months out of the year. But occasionally they are concerned that they may have some issues. And the problem is if they spend the $14 million and upgrade the facility that would be required, there's a current carp infestation in the lake that would mute any benefits of that infrastructure upgrade. And so the plan here is to, the district has worked with the scientists and we're working with the MPCA to attempt some lake management activities that very likely, according to the district scientists, could bring the lake into attainment with the standard without the requirement for the infrastructure upgrade. And so the goal here is to try to solve this problem for somewhere between $600,000 to $1 million rather than spending $14 million. And it could save the state up to about $7 million because of the $14 million infrastructure upgrade would be eligible for up to $7 million in PSIG funding through the PFA. And we've been working very closely with the PCA. The PCA has gone above and beyond to work with the district in this effort. And we would encourage your support. And I think the PCA would probably want to comment as well. But I have nothing further.
Thank you for your testimony. So save the water, kill the carp.
Save the water, kill the carp, save money for the state.
There you go. Welcome to the committee. Additional testifiers come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Greta Gothier. I'm the legislative director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to testify on House File 3519 as amended. I'm very happy to be here today to talk to you about or to testify on this bill because we're very excited about this project. It's a very innovative approach to address cleanup in a couple of lakes, taking them from an impaired status to non-impaired, and also addressing the need for phosphorus reduction in that community. Mr. Chairman and members, the amendment follows the path that we have been working on with the Alexandria Lakes Area Sanitary District to find a solution that is both protective of water quality and cost-efficient. We think this, again, is a very innovative approach that achieves both of those goals. We hope that it will be a model that other communities where the wastewater treatment plant discharges into a lake. It's a very different scenario than when it discharges into a river where you have moving water and flow. So we're hoping that because this is a lake discharge situation, that this can be a model perhaps for other communities in Minnesota that also have inherited a situation where their wastewater treatment plant discharges into a lake. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Anderson, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not.
This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, and seeing no any comments or questions from the committee, Representative Anderson, you get the last word.
Thank you very much, members. Met this morning and was excited to see the compromise and working together, and this is a good bill. Thank you.
That Representative Anderson renews his motion to have House File 3519 as amended, laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Anderson, and to our testifiers. Representative Mahoney moves House File 4179. Are you ready, Tim?
See which one that is.
4179, the African Economic. Yeah. Yep. Representative Mahoney moves House File 4179 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Hey, Dan.
Carp. Carp.
Hello. Carp. 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 Okay. So I told her we were going to have her go forth, so just let me know. Oh, she didn't ask for that? Okay, never mind. Welcome to the Representative Mahoney to House File 4179.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. My testifiers, he's done a good job of bringing people here. I hope they understand that we're trying to move quickly today. The African Economic Development Solutions Organization has a focus on helping immigrants from Africa, but it's not exclusive to that particular, to immigrants only. It helps many people of African descent. They have been, and I'll be brief here, they have been working for a relatively short time. I'm sure Gene here will give you a little more detail on how they've grown, but they have expanded the number of people they've been able to help and the number of jobs they've been able to help set the table for. So without any added words by me, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member of the mic over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. Thank you so much. Today, I'm not only testifying, I'm giving thanks for these members. In 2015, we got the funding from state appropriation in partnership with other member of nonprofit organization. And as you see on this paper in front of you, we did not only increase our staffing capacity. Raise your hand, ages of staff in here. Last time when I came here to testify in front of you, I myself and a part-time admin assistant. Today we are 8 employees here to testify. This is because of your investment. You invested on the infrastructure, and we not only transformed our organization, we transformed the community to 195 new clients we supported since 2015. And out of those clients, it's 50% of male, 45% were female, 5% not disclosed. And the number of people that not only we supported, but they created jobs, strengthening our local economy. And sample of those businesses we supported here with me to testify. The first person is Frau Usha.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Fraoli Usha. I'm the owner of Twin City Mobility. 2009, I went to ADS for business training. The same year, I started Twin City Mobility, Inc. I'm unable to expand the business because of the lack of access to capital. I work Monday through Friday on my own business, and weekends I work for other company to support my family. I try to get a loan from a bank, including the bank where I bank, unsuccessfully. My hard work didn't help me, my business barely surviving. In 2015, ADS took a risk on me and invested on marketing, accounting, business management, capacity building support. And as a result, I was able to secure a contract and added 5 employees. This was a great transformation for us who struggled for many years to sustain my business. In 2016, ADS provided a small loan capital to us to help me improve my credit so that we can attract more loan capital for my growing business. I paid back the loan, but the challenge still exists. Supporting this bill will help small business like me to access loan fund as I request you support business tribe. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have additional testifiers, Representative Mahoney?
Yes.
Good. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
My name is William Etta Kennedy, and I'm a business owner in the Coon Rapids area. I'm a widow with two children. I've worked for Wells Fargo for 15 years and rose to the position of a senior disbursement specialist. I resigned the position going after my American dream, owning my own business and trying to support it. In 2011, I started the business in the Coon Rapids area, and the business has grown, and we have my revenue has doubled. But it's a challenge trying to get loan for minority. I reached out to the organization, and I must admit they have been extremely helpful with technical assistance, and you know, I haven't gotten funding yet, but they've been helping me with training. So I'm here today to lend my voice to ask to support this bill, because they have helped me, and we've identified other stores that I want to open in the Twin Cities and also in the St. Clair area, where there's a huge, diverse population. So I'm depending on this bill to help to expand my business, because right now I funded my business from my 401k. I just took the risk, the faith, and it has really been a challenge securing loan. And they've tried to help, but funding for me is really an issue. I've extended the business. Right now I've added a deli to the grocery store, and I'm situated just opposite the technical college, Anoka Technical College, and I have only one staff, and I'm just not able to deliver the kind of food that the college students need. So I'm just coming here appealing to the party to please approve this bill to help me to expand my business. And before I leave, I want to say thank you, especially thank you to the representative for the hard work done. You know, I jokingly say to other people in the states that we're operating from a surplus, and it's struggling for the states. So I just want to say thank you.
Next testifier, please come forward. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. And please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sigerida Chernet. I have my own business, which is in a 2585 West 7. The name is Agave Ethiopian Restaurant. Before I start this, I've been contacting with Gilgalu 2014. I take a class with them, but I was a single mom, and then I don't have enough money. I didn't get a loan. I have to go back to work and then save that money. I come back to him again and then start this business last November, which is with a partner. We use our save money, but they were supporting us with a marketing loan. We didn't get a loan, but marketing or accounting, and then being there anytime when I need them. I don't even have to go to the office. Sometimes they came there and then helping me out, but still didn't get the loan. We still have hard time. But the business improving. It was a coffee shop. Now we make restaurant and then make it more. And then we create for three people, which is me and my partner. Instead of being hiring for somebody, now I'm hiring myself, my partner, and I have another worker too. So I strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any additional testifiers on this bill?
No. No. Thank you so much. This is a sample of people that we supported. And some you can see from Coon Rapids, some from Lakeville, and some from St. Paul. It's very diversified from location perspective. And also the industry, also very diverse industry we support. In 2015, Dr. Bruce Corey, who is a Concordia University Associate Vice Chair, now is at City of St. Paul, did research on African immigrant market study funded by McKnight.
67% of African immigrants have difficulty of accessing a loan fund. Minnesota Compass also indicate that research, 35.2% of African immigrants live under poverty. So that means we as a state having this kind of institution, creating, supporting businesses, it create more job, it increase our tax base, and also it strengthens our future. So this investment, as you see, the what you invested on, the return on investment is huge. Now, the bottleneck for AEDs is a loan fund, as you hear. The loan fund is difficult for AEDs to secure. So by investing on this loan fund as a state, as a region, we are investing in our future. I strongly request for you to invest on this revolving loan fund.
Thank you very much. And are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions and comments. Seeing none, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had the opportunity to visit the location and hear from many of the community members who have had to utilize the services to become the small business owner, the job creators that they have become. And just want to say thank you for your work, the technical support that you give to members of the African community is so needed. The loan process where the traditional loans just doesn't seem to work for that community, you are providing that service and standing in a gap to create these entrepreneurs and these opportunities. So I just want to say thank you for your work.
Thank
you for your service and to all these business owners who are stepping out and trying to reach that American dream. Keep working at it. Don't give up the hope. Keep working at it.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the African Economic Development Solutions Organization is a really good organization that reaches out in a culturally coherent manner. As if you look at the demographics and where businesses or cultural organizations are, they concentrate in particular areas more or less along transit lines. This is the typical immigrant story, whether it is from 1776 to today. Our immigrant population comes, they start businesses, they become part of the community, their kids grow up, and they join into other businesses, whether it's the Fortune 500 companies or they start their own business or take over mom and dad's business. This is a way to help our community continue to grow together, and create more economic opportunity. I strongly ask for your support.
With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 4179 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Thank you to our testifiers.
Thank you.
Representative West.
Thank you again.
Representative West, do you have any? Good. Members, as Representative West goes to the front testifying table, we'll note for the members of the committee, the hazing level is set too high. So, Representative West moves House File 3284 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And Representative West, there is a A180755 amendment. Is that your amendment?
Yes.
Representative West moves that amendment to get the bill in the form that he would like. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. All say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative West, 2-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3284 is a bill that allows modular homes to be placed in manufactured housing parks if there is no local ordinance and to the contrary, and if the manufactured housing park wants it. The amendment that was added on there made some changes to requested by the Department of Labor Industry just to make sure we have peace in the valley. So we're all hunky-dory here. And I am passing out food, even though it is not my first bill. I felt like on a Friday we could use more food. I have Mark Brunner here to provide a little more details on the bill.
Representative West, first of all, do you have a statutory definition of hunky-dory? Or no?
All right. Future amendment.
All right. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We're the trade group that represents the builders of manufactured homes, modular homes, as well as the manufactured home park communities, lenders, and sales centers. And we thank Representative West for bringing this bill. We think it makes a lot of sense. And just to give the committee a little better idea of what it is I'm talking about, I do just have a handout, if the page could distribute it, so you can sort of visually see what we're talking about and trying to differentiate between a manufactured home and a modular home. So the purpose of the bill is to address choice about a 1950 statute that originally established manufactured home parks as being licensed under the Department of Health, and it states that manufactured homes shall be sited in a manufactured home park. One of the things that we've seen in the past several years is an interest in more unique designs, smaller homes, and for manufactured homes, the way their construction built, which is the federal building code, doesn't allow for as great a flexibility as the modular building code does for, as you can see in the photos, dormers, those kinds of things. Obviously, the home's a little more costly. So what we're attempting to do is allow a modular home that is built to the state IRC building code, it's the same as a residential code, to be located in a manufactured home park community. The modular homes are built in the same plants as manufactured homes. The difference is the code they're built to. Both are regulated by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. We worked with the department on this language. Matter of fact, the amendment you just added clarified a little bit the definition, and we think it makes sense relative to manufactured home parks. There are 900 of them in the state of Minnesota, about 50,000 home sites, and this would be an opportunity for those who seek a smaller footprint, some unique designs in for workforce housing, to be able to site these homes in a manufactured home park, which they currently can't simply because of the 1950 statute. That's the quick overview of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Representative West, do you have any additional testifiers?
No.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion, move to member questions and comments. When I first read this bill, I was kind of like surprised this was still this way. It just seems like kind of someone in the last 70 years would have fixed this law. Do you know what the story is? Why has there been any opposite? Did someone just kind of stumble across this? What's the history of it?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, in some ways, our association started getting calls from our members because people were interested in locating a smaller modular home in a manufactured home park, and the statute says you can't do that, so they were rejected. So it's really coming from some of my members throughout the state that have an interest in this and sort of the popularity today of, smaller homes. And it is a way for us to rejuvenate these properties, and I think the next bill we'll talk about relating to closures, this may be a terrific offset to that.
So, Representative West, any closing comments?
No.
With that, Representative West renews his motion to have House File 3284 as amended laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative West, House File 3285. And do you have any amendments for your bill?
No, sir.
So Representative West moves House File 3285 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative West, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3285 is actually a provision in the governor's budget as well. This increases the cap on the trust fund for manufactured housing relocation from $1 million to $3 million. This fund is funded through individual manufactured housing parks. It is not funded by the state. It has almost run out of money lately with the $1 million cap, so it's prudent that we increase it to $3 million to make sure that these individuals have the funds which they put there to help with the relocation. It also has the Department of Health keep a list of all manufactured housing parks. Right now there's no master list in the state, and they agree that this is something that the state should manage. It also increases the demolition costs from $1,000 to $3,000. As prices go up, we thought it would be prudent to increase that cost. That is one difference we have with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which they will testify on this bill today. But for the most part, we have broad agreement. And I have Mark Brunner to add a few more details.
Welcome back to the committee. Please restate your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Chair. Mark Brunner, Manufactured Modular Home Association. Maybe fill in a couple of the blanks regarding the trust fund. It was established in 2007, and in its way, the advocate groups, the industry, got together to address closures of manufactured home parks. There aren't many, but there have been a couple of recent rather high-profile ones of larger properties that were built in the 1950s, which the previous bill addresses. And what it does is provides relocation assistance or buyout assistance for those who can't find those homeowners being displaced that perhaps can't find another home site for their property. Otherwise, if they can, there's some reassistance, tear down, moving costs where it's reimbursed. And what the bill does, it extends out the range from 25 miles to 50 miles to receive coverage, increases the cap on the fund, as Representative West said, from $1 million to $3 million. The fund, the balance was brought down to about $80,000 as a result of this couple of recent closures and the issue regarding providing lists to MMB for collection. There currently is no way. The way MMB does the collections is they send an invoice to the owner of the manufactured home park. They pay that invoice based on the number of home sites times 15. There are a few deductions that are allowed for vacant some home sites, that kind of thing. So what this does is gives access to MMB, to the list of licensees. Their recent invoicing in 2017, I think of 900 invoices they sent out, I think about 300 came back. Simply because they didn't have accurate addresses. So this just creates a pathway to update that process. And we've worked with the advocates on this housing finance agency, and I think we've got we're in a pretty good place right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative West, do you have any additional testifiers?
No.
This is a public hearing. Are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? I'm sorry, your name is on the list. My apologies. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Katie Topinka. I'm the legislative director at Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We just wanted to share, as Representative West mentioned, that the governor included a similar provision in his supplemental budget bill to increase the cap of the relocation trust fund from $1 million to $3 million, as was already stated last year with two large park closures. The fund did dip to under $100,000 balance. And so we think raising that up to $3 million will help in the event of any large park closures in the future. There are a few differences that we've been working on between what's in the governor's proposal and what's in this proposal, the demolition credit being one, and just some adjustments on the timing and the reporting requirement. So we're continuing to work those out, but we're pretty close to being on the same page, and just wanted to share that the biggest item of increasing the cap on the fund from $1 million to $3 million is something that is also in the governor's proposal and we think is really important, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to take questions if there are any for us.
Thank you for your testimony. And for either of the testifiers, and perhaps you said this and I missed it, when we raise the cap, assuming there were no withdrawals from the fund, what are the amount of deposits into this fund on an annual basis?
Mr. Chair, last year, MMB collected about $400,000 with the assessment.
Gotcha. Any questions or comments for either of the testifiers? Thank you. Any additional members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Representative West, closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative West renews his motion to have House File 3285 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And you have a third bill, Representative West? How did I do that? Representative West moves House File 3807 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative West, there's no amendments to the bill. Is that correct?
Correct.
To your bill, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is why I brought cookies. This bill modifies the home installer's fees from $300 for manufactured housing from $300 to $180. There was a big reform push that changed all sorts of licenses in the last few years, and this is considered just overlooked, and we are cleaning that up. And I have Mark Bruning here for some additional testimony.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the tape once again.
Mr. Chair, Mark Bruner, manufactured modular home station in Minnesota, and as Representative West said, this is really a cleanup piece. Last session, the Department of Labor and Industry, in its housekeeping bill, lowered licensing fees for contractors as a result of them receiving more revenue from the uptick in building permits and inspections, those kinds of things. We were in the omnibus bill, and then it was discovered that there were actually two provisions in statute governing the fees for manufactured home installers, who are a category of contractors, and we agreed we'd just pull back, work through that, and we worked with the department on this language, and they have no objections to it. It simply brings down the fee for installers that other types of contractors received last session. Thank you.
Anyone from the department here want to give us a thumbs up on this? No? Okay, we'll just believe you then. any other members of the public who is testifying in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close public comment. Move to member questions and comments. Oh, Representative Anderson, did you seek recognition? No? All right, never mind. Representative West. Yeah. Representative West, any closing comments on your bill?
Short and sweet is good.
With that, Representative West renews his motion to have House File 3807 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. Representative Mahoney, House File 4377. And Representative Mahoney, do you have any amendments to your bill?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Representative Mahoney moves House File 4377 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Mahoney, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably going to be the longest bill of the day, unfortunately. This is a new concept for me. I have never been a big supporter of for-profit economic development organizations. This bill directs up to $5 million over the next couple of years to do a pilot program with an organization, LSI, is it, sir, the page, why don't you give them to the page? They'll pass out, the pages will be passing out a PowerPoint that Chip Langland will be giving. What this is a grant to Logistics Specialists Incorporated. It's to do a pilot program focused on government contracts. And the government spends trillions and trillions of dollars every year. Minnesota is one of the worst states for getting government contracts. And in some areas, we're number 50. So what I'm trying to do is start a pilot program to start a organization that will focus statewide on procurement of government contracts so we can get off the bottom of that list. The interesting piece with LSI is that they go after the contract that the government is asking for, whether it's fencing, food, clothing, military equipment, or whatever. This is a focus on small and mid-sized businesses in economically depressed areas. So it could be, and in my area, my particular district, I have about 20% immigrants who are always looking for a better job. They don't like government assistance. They want to get off of it. And these are jobs that are looking to create family-sustaining incomes. Let's see, I better get back to my notes here. LSI does not just get the contract, hand it to the company, and walk away. They work with them in terms of how do you work with the federal government in terms of procuring, servicing, and bringing the company to complete the contract to completion. thus far you impress the government procurement officers, and you're more likely to get more contracts and create more jobs in the state of Minnesota. This is focused on the East Metro. And again, it's focused on an area of economic challenges. What the other piece that they do, and is really kind of supportive for our Fortune 500s, is that the federal government requires a certain diversity in contracts. So they will take that, let's say they help a company start making a piece of fencing. And that's tied into one of, I'll use a better example, HVAC equipment for whether it's Middle East stations that we have with the military or U.S. aid for cows. And you're building a fence or a fan or whatever, they collaborate with some of our Fortune 500s that get a bigger contract to service this particular piece. What I think this can do is it can go in St. Paul, it can go in Wilmer, it can go in up in the North Shore. It can go and help areas of economic distress and bring jobs and small businesses to companies, to cities and areas across the state. I've been excited about this. I think if this works, I would like to start working on how we get the state, whether it's a deed or a department with the governor's office, that actually works on trying to get federal contracts, whether it's for food products or steel products. I don't really care which. But we should go out and get this stuff because we are quite close to 50th out of the states in our government procurement contracts. With that, I will leave it. I will introduce Chip Langland, who will do a short PowerPoint presentation, and hopefully we can find some money to make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Mr. Chair, fellow representatives, thank you so much for taking the time on a pre-blizzard afternoon for welcoming us in here. My name is Chip Langan. For the record, my full name is Charles. I work for Logistics Specialties, Inc., and we'll refer to that today as LSI. I was told by the legislative assistants about an hour ago to bring a VGA cable. I come from the military background, so we gave up those about 20 years ago. So we don't have the ability to project the presentation, but we can certainly email that to you afterwards. But you do hopefully have it in front of you. If you don't, there's more folders behind me. So I'll refer to the slides as we go. I do have a colleague with me, Mr. Norb Biederman, if I can refer to him, Mr. Chair, and I would like to ask him to contribute as we go also. Norb is a 36-year 3Mer, recently retired, also referred to by me as the brains of the outfit. So that's why he's here with me today. So what I'd like to do is talk about the intent of what we would like to do on the east side of St. Paul as a pilot project, as Representative Mahoney says, to replicate hopefully elsewhere in Minnesota, as LSI has done very successfully in Utah and now is starting to implement in the state of Colorado. I'll give a corporate overview about who LSI is, so you have that background. And then I'll describe our methodology, which we think is significantly unique in terms of economic development and how it's practiced on the ground, and then get into some detail on what a St. Paul pilot project would look like for this type of methodology. We'll talk a little bit about past performance in previous projects and then open it up to questions. So the purpose, simply stated, is to conduct a pilot of what we call job creation and placement, or JCAP methodology, in St. Paul, Minnesota. This methodology is data-driven. It's human-centered. You can read the definition on that slide number two. Bottom line is here, I've been in and around economic development ever since I retired from the military in 2004. During my career in the military, I was part of the most diverse organization on the planet, known as the U.S. military. So I've been in and around challenged demographics
and economic development situations my whole career, and most especially here in Minnesota for the past 15 years. And we see, LSICs, I've seen, NORB has seen, a lot of incredible efforts that go into workforce development, skills training, what we call broadly economic development, not just here but all over the country. And as you all know, massive amounts of dollars get poured into these demographics. And quite frankly, it looks like the needle's not moving a lot on outcomes. This methodology, what LSI does, is focus on outcomes. So that's kind of, I just wanted to kind of get that out up front, that we've been in and around this. We understand small business. We understand challenged communities and demographics. And we know what it takes to move the needle. And it's tough, admittedly. So slide three is just kind of an outline of the goals, and we'll come back to this. We want to produce, first and foremost, quality jobs for people in communities where it's tough to get them and to keep them and to parlay them into career paths that are long-term, not just a short-term job, an internship, $10 an hour. We're talking career paths, a continuum we will stay with individuals for their entire careers. Second, we want to remove people from public assistance, state principally, but also federal system assistance like TANF dollars and WIO and things like that. As I said, a lot of money going into that. Those pots of money were intended to get them started and get them off of public assistance. We want to do that with this program. Third, we want to build capacity for the community stakeholders. There's a lot of amazing folks right here in St. Paul doing amazing things, whether it be Neighborhood Development Corporation, the East Side Enterprise Center. There's countless folks doing skills training, workforce training. We don't want to come in and unseat those community partners. They're doing valuable work. We want to come in and complement those efforts and build their capacity for the future. We can assist business growth and startups by partnering with neighborhood businesses that exist here or could exist, or even regional partners that can help with business startups with incubators and other things. I know NDC does some of that already. We've had a good conversation with them. They're very interested in this methodology. And really, to Tim, Representative Mahoney's point, we want to win federal contracts and other funding opportunities to add to this methodology, to add to dollars that are already being pumped into things like TANF and WIOA and state assistance. There's, as Representative Mahoney said, we are literally, last time I checked, 49th in the nation in the return on our federal tax dollar. That's not great. Now, some people say, well, this is Minnesota, we're self-sufficient, we don't need federal dollars, and there's something to that, absolutely. But having said that, there's still a whole bunch of federal money that's going everywhere else but Minnesota, and quite frankly, to places like North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa. Not that they don't deserve it either, but it's time to be competitive and win some of that money, bring it in here, and leverage it into these efforts that we're talking about. We can move the needle on that. We've been doing that as a company for over 45 years. And then finally, we want to position LSI, as Representative Mahoney said, we're a for-profit company. We want to grow our practice as well. We think this methodology has such promise that we can bring it into places like East St. Paul for a pilot project, prove the concept, and then take it out state. I'm on the fourth slide just to give you kind of a snapshot of what LSI is. If you go to LSI.com, you probably won't find us. It's LSIwins.com. We like to say we win a lot of contracts. We've been around as a government solutions provider for, as I said, almost 50 years. It's Utah-based, but we have 54 locations and some overseas as well. Because of what this market represents from an industry's perspective, healthcare, energy, advanced materials, robotics, high-tech, medical defense, there's a lot of things here that the corporate office in Utah said we need to expand and go after opportunities in Minnesota. And so that's why we opened an office here in early 2017. You all need to come by and see our corporate office on the 20th floor of Landmark Towers. And we have the only, we think, the only balcony in town. So come on by and check it out. I really want to stress that LSI really represents, well, there's three practice areas. A very small practice area is logistics solutions. We started in that region for the Department of Defense almost 50 years ago. But the company has expanded largely into two major practice areas that complement each other. One is business development. We do a lot of connection, obviously, with the federal government, winning contracts for large businesses, medium and small businesses. And we do economic development. We will do all the things you all know about most likely in terms of workforce development and skills training, a lot of things that nonprofits do here in Minnesota. We do those things, too. We just implement a different methodology, and we combine it with our business development practice. It's an integrative approach, which I'll describe. We also have a history of cluster creation and management. I come from the military, as I said, and the word cluster has different connotations. Here we're talking about clustering industry practice areas together, moving groups of businesses together to achieve greater success and more contracts. And as I said, we have active engagements all over the country. Right now, I think it's 425 active engagements with both business partners and government partners as well. I'm on slide five. I just wanted to give you a snapshot of how we think. And this especially represents Norb Biederman and myself. We come from organizations that are very complex. The military and 3M, a lot of times we joke that they're kind of similar in their dysfunction and the great things they do as well. But we come from an understanding that to make complex systems work, you have to be integrative. And that represents what we do as a methodology when it comes to economic development. And second, we approach challenges, whether it be in business or in communities where challenges exist, with a business perspective. We're looking for outcomes. We're looking for a bottom line. We don't want to just fund something to fund something and train people just to give them skills. We're going to connect those things to a bottom line, and that's the integration piece, and that's the outcomes piece. We're very business-focused. The profit is if we can get somebody off public assistance into a job that makes $10 an hour and then 12 and then 20, and then we're talking career-type things, educations, master's degrees. That's what we want to do. We're talking outcomes. We want to make a profit for those individuals that are in these challenged demographics and neighborhoods. So we're on slide six. This is that methodology that we're very proud of in LSI. If you're lost, it's this one. Now, if you look at the, if I was projecting this, I would project just the right side first, and to say that, again, there's a lot of people in Minnesota and all over the country that are doing that right side, the constant churn of human capital, studying the census tracts, finding out where the challenges are, getting these folks the soft skills training they need, getting them to show up to work. We do that. We do that differently as well, but it's not largely different from what goes on now. The difference is we bring in that second cog and we combine it with the right side there. The left side is the business development piece. It's the market sectors. It's the strategic opportunities that reside out there. We're the partner in this effort that looks at what else can we leverage while we're training this workforce on the right to put them into when they come out of it. There's all kinds of things, federal contracts, state contracts. We want to be that integrative partner that looks at this as a machine, a complex machine, and provides business outcomes that we know are inherent in that machine. The next slide describes the right side of that cog, which is how we go about the human piece of this. That individual in East St. Paul that is one of those demographics that is by definition in an economic development perspective right now challenged. And we go in and we assign career advocates. Everybody has their terms for these things. But our career advocates are hands-on. They're hired from within the community. They're LSI employees, but they're from that community. They look like them. They understand the issues. And they track these folks all the way through their careers. So this represents a continuum where we're moving people from employability to experience where they're employed and then to enriching that experience. We call that the three E's that are on this chart. I'm on slide eight now. This is the proposal itself for St. Paul. And admittedly, this is a sketch. because this is something that would have to be well-defined with our community partners in this effort, and it would depend on the funding that comes in. Our initial ask for this endeavor is $5 million. That would go to a cohort of individuals in one of these census tracts, and the project would be, again, to leverage and integrate the resources that are there, combine that with the skills training, the workforce training that happens naturally, into an effort to grow jobs in that sector. If you go to the next slide, this is really what the outcome is. Back to the business focus inherent with what we look at. We want to produce jobs that are family sustainable in terms of wages and have career growth potential. And that's part of that continuum I discussed. We want to remove people from state assistance for the long term. We want to build capacity for those community stakeholders. LSI comes in and does a pilot project and maybe more. We don't want to stay there. We want to produce outcomes and make sure the community is sustainable on its own with those partners. Assisting business growth and startups, winning those federal contracts and other contracts, foundation grants, whatever they are, that connect to this greater issue. And then again, position LSI to replicate this methodology elsewhere. As I mentioned, this is done successfully in Utah with ongoing programs, and now it's being adopted in Colorado as we speak. The National Association of Counties is looking at this as kind of the go-to standard for workforce training methodology and tying it to business outcomes. I'm on the first of two slides that describe past performance. There's a lot of things that go into measuring what the outcomes are for economic development efforts. And I'll be the first to tell you I'm not an expert on this. That's my disclaimer for when the questions start. If there's any experts out there that have been immersed in the workforce development field forever, some of these numbers hopefully are compelling and understandable to you. The top of that first slide represents an economic expansion pilot that happened in Utah. This was a very short-run program with not much funding that was based at the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, the PTAC. If you don't know that, Minnesota has one. That would be a community partner for us here as well. In 1 year, you can see the goals and the results, pretty significant in terms of placement of folks after 1 year of funding in that small program. That blue program at the top represents, again, kind of that business development angle to this. The bottom piece is an example of a job training and placement program, which, by the way, has just been refunded in Utah, with the demographics on the left, the graduate numbers, and then the return on investment on the right. These numbers, by the way, in Utah were derived not by LSI but by a third party, the state legislative data technician or something. I don't know his title exactly, but it was derived by the state, which largely funded this effort. And you can see the return on investment for that first program, 29-1. For the state investment, $3.50 for every dollar invested in the skills training aspect. And that's largely derived from benefits that the state obtains in terms of less spending in typical efforts, state-funded efforts for workforce training. The next slide is slide 11. It looks like this, if anybody's lost, and this is the second of the past performance that we talk about at LSI, and this really relates to the LSI office here. As I said, we just started here in 2017 as a branch office for the national effort based in Salt Lake, but we've already got some great traction, some great clients. The first thing I mentioned is business development. 3M is a client of ours. You might imagine why. We're doing supplier diversity for them already very successfully, which may connect to an East Side project in St. Paul. And we have numerous small and medium-sized businesses that already signed up for LSI as fee-based clients. In terms of economic development, we actually have a state-funded project that's about to be underway. We have a commitment from the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, formerly known as IRRRB. I would say the further north you get, the more R's you get in your name. And so we went to DIRRR as a client of the Natural Resources Research Institute, which I believe was here earlier today. We're doing work for NRRI, which is a University of Minnesota effort. In that context, we went to DIRRR and said, look, there's all these things that happen in Minnesota around natural resources, mining, forestry products, land use, water applications. This is the epicenter of all things natural resources in Minnesota. And back to the integrative piece of how things move in the economy, we're not good at capitalizing on that effort. So we're hopefully being funded starting June 1st by the state to put together a proof of concept for what we're calling Enterprise for Strategic Enterprise for Strategic Resources, ESR, to be that integrative effort to make Minnesota the center of excellence for the use and sustainability of natural resources, including a data center. And again, there's all kinds of federal dollars we're chasing in that effort to match the state's investment. We're also on the Full Stack Committee of St. Paul, the steering committee for the people piece of that, which is a new effort connected to the several years old effort in the city of St. Paul for the vision of bringing more high-tech and high-quality jobs to St. Paul. So we're already kind of integrated in the community from that perspective. And the third thing I'll mention is LSI acquired an effort that I put together with a team starting in 2005, roughly, here in Minnesota called Defense Alliance, which Representative Mahoney has been a big champion of for many years, much appreciated. That entity from 2011 to 2017 had federal dollars to assist small businesses to chase federal contracts. So essentially now that is under LSI. It's been acquired by the company. So in some ways, our presence has been here already since 2011 from a federally funded perspective. And again, Defense Alliance was here starting in 2005. And if you look at the investment that we achieved out of that one industry effort, over six, 7 years roughly, the feds provided $3 million in funding to the average of about $400,000 a year. The outcomes are pretty staggering. Measured by a third party, by the Small Business Administration, for a 51 to return on the tax dollar. We've brought in $225 million in contracts for companies that have been part of the Defense Alliance Network. And in that effort also, we created 2,200 high-tech jobs. Now, unfortunately, that wasn't all in Minnesota, but we have membership now in 34 states. But it was centered right here with federal dollars coming into that effort. So, in summary, we have that two-gear cog picture for you on that page. I just wanted to throw that back at you and say, look, just to remind you, this is an integrative effort. Why hire a for-profit firm? Why hire someone that you think economic development is already happening? This is different. This is notably different. This is a way to integrate all those partners, to be that overlay, to really make this system here in St. Paul and then statewide, sing. I mean, again, there's a lot of money going into this. Let's do something a little different with it. Let's make it integrative and let's chase outcomes because this affects individuals that need it and can contribute greatly to the state. Mr. Chair, if I may ask my colleague to chime in as well. We have time.
Please introduce yourself for the record. And continue.
Sure can. Full name, Norbert Biederman, B-I-D-E-R-M-A-N. Just to compliment what Chip said, really this is about people, and this is really about driving business to the east side of St. Paul and leveraging the combination of that both in workforce development, workforce training, getting the people trained and ready for these types of jobs, and then attracting new business to the state and to the city. That's really what our objective and our goal is. And this project demonstrates that. And I can assure you that the metrics that will be derived from it will be very accountable and measurable and will provide the type of return on investment this committee expects. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, do you have any other invited?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not. Happy to take any questions that the committee may have.
Are there any members of the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? With that, we'll close public testimony, and we'll go to member questions. Representative Barr, seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure really who to direct this to, maybe Chip. Should this is a pilot program, so if it was successful, where would your continued funding be? Would you expect the legislature or the state to continue to fund this, or do you charge some kind of administrative fee to the companies that you work coordinate between, so for your ongoing funding?
Mr. Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barr, terrific question. I think, I hate to say it depends, but it depends. We look at every pilot project, every project we do, as very customizable, and it will represent, when we're done, something that we didn't probably expect completely when we started, right? So we'll do a comprehensive assessment. We've already started to do that. At what the potential is in this region to begin with, and we know a lot about what the state has potential with, too. I mentioned the DIRRR effort with the natural resources. But in the end, the idea is to make this sustainable on its own, right? And you do that by bringing people to jobs and then to careers with family-sustainable wages and futures so that we can get rid of all this, right? That's the ultimate goal. Having said that, as I said, we're a for-profit business. We would like to keep doing what we do elsewhere. But programs would, so to speak, graduate from our services. One other thing that may happen is we may decide that there's a reason to produce something like Defense Alliance was. That was that industry cluster that I mentioned for the defense industry. Maybe on a fee-based services type of model, maybe not. Defense Alliance was free because the feds were paying for it. But ultimately, that kind of business alliance could be a fee-based industry alliance or market sector alliance that funds itself. For the natural resources effort with DIRRR and RRI, that will likely be likely represent significant federal dollars coming in. One of the things we want to do with that effort is create what we're calling an integration and data center. Because as we learn all these things and catalog all these resources around natural resources, which nobody else is doing in the country, not even the federal labs, like most of you know, big data is the future, and there's money in big data. We want to capitalize off of that. So that industry economic development effort could self-sustain on its own just from the data that we derive. Now, that's, you know, that's a pretty big vision, but certainly possible. And so that's the kind of thing we try to do is chart something out where, yeah, let's get the feds out of it. Let's get the state out of it. Let's let it run as a business. If it doesn't do that, it's probably not worth doing in the end.
Representative Mahoney?
And Mr. Chair, and although I applaud Chip's desire to get outside of government funding. If this pilot works in the way that I am watching it and hoping that it does work, I think the state would be well advised to continue funding at some level, because once you have a pilot, more times you do it, the less money you have to put into it. And whether it's in Grand Rapids or Duluth or Hallock or Worthington or St. Paul or Minneapolis, any place that there is a cohort of unused human capital, this is something that could work and bring communities together to continue this and continue the funding on their own, so to speak. So, yes, I think it will be coming back to – if this pilot works, I would expect it to come back and come back for every particular legislator's district.
And, Mr. Chair, if I can add one thing.
To
supplement that, I would say the state's going to ask, you know, why should we continue this, and that's going to be based on the outcomes, right, back to the business angle of this. One of the things we do is we have what we call an active case management system, ACMS, which is relatively unique that we've seen among active economic development efforts. We have a comprehensive database that tracks every interaction and ties it to outcomes. And so when Deed or whoever the master of this particular project is comes to us and says, you know, why should we do this again, we've got real data that's backed up from real case studies as we go here.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. Representative Mahoney, any closing comments?
I believe, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I do believe that we need to think, I hate this term, but outside of the box of what we've been doing in economic development, workforce training, and moving people into career-sustaining, family-sustaining wages, wage jobs. I think this is something that is well worth the state's investment to try and to see if doing something different gives us a better result than we've been getting. So I ask for your support, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 4377 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Bar C. Representative Barrs moves House File 3003 for possible inclusion in a later bill, and Representative Barr, the DE1 amendment is yours. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Barr, I know that this bill, this amendment puts the bill in the form that you like, but it is substantially different than the underlying bill. So I'm wondering if this might be, I'm looking at Mr. Eloff. Is it okay if, Mr. Eloff, can you do a brief overview of the delete all amendment just so, because it is so much different than the underlying bill. Is that okay, Representative Barr?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Barr moves the DE1 amendment, and Mr. Eloff to explain the DE1 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the DE1 amendment does significantly change the bill. You'll notice in paragraph A, lines 1.5 to 110, what it says is that the solar energy standard, which was established, I believe, in 2013, applies to public utility with more than 200,000 residential electric customers, of which there's only one in the state. And that standard requires that at least 1.5% of the utility's total retail electric sales be generated from solar energy by the end of the year 2020. The language in paragraph C that is stricken in the DE1 also applied that same requirement to public utilities between 50 and 200,000 residential retail electric customers, and that language is no longer part of the statute. And the rest of the bill just makes corresponding changes to accord with that major substance. It also, in paragraph E at the bottom of page 1, deletes the state energy goal of 10% of retail electric sales in Minnesota generated by solar energy by 2030. And that concludes the summary, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Eloff. Representative Barr, did you wish to add anything about the amendment, or just wish to, us to adopt your amendment? Then?
Just to adopt the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of the delete all amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The delete all amendment is adopted. Representative Barr, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intent of the DE here is to bring a little more, a little less government mandates to the electric utilities providers of this state, and free up a few more options for just less government mandates overall. That's all it does.
Do you have any invited testifiers, Representative Barr?
No, Mr. Chair, I do not.
This is a public hearing. David Schaefer, have you signed up to testify? Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns to the bill? Just please come on down and line up to testify. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is David Schaefer. I'm with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a 501c6 trade association. We represent about 100 different solar businesses in Minnesota. And for the record, Minnesota has about 4,000 solar employees around the state. There's 4,000 solar jobs. And this bill, as amended, would jeopardize the, maybe not the vast majority of them, but a good number of them. The solar energy standard is incredibly important towards generating utility-scale solar. And so there's two projects that I know of that are going forward. One's in Minnesota Power Service Territory that's a 10-megawatt. Another's a 30-megawatt project that's in Otter Tail Service Territory. There are some studies that suggest there's about 28 jobs per megawatt of solar. So if this bill were to go forward and those projects were jeopardized and lost, that's about 1,000 jobs right there that could be potentially lost from this bill. It should be noted that we found out about this amendment yesterday, and so I asked this committee to consider this fact very carefully before adding this to an omnibus bill. Furthermore, this would eliminate the small-scale solar carve-out, which is something that Otter Tail and Minnesota Power sought last year and successfully had amended to allow for community solar garden subscriptions to come forward, as well as 40-kilowatt-sized systems. So there doesn't seem to be any further need to help them reach these goals, since they should be reaching them on their own accord. Further eliminating this particular provision of this solar energy standard really does nothing for the state of Minnesota. And most importantly, it really harms businesses that have come here looking to build projects and install solar with the promise that these goals and standards would be here from now until 2030. And so really the most detrimental part of this entire bill is not even the loss of potentially the 1,000 jobs from these utility-scale projects or the rooftop projects that come with the SolarSense program, which potentially might go away if this bill is passed, but the 2030 goal of a 10% solar standard, solar energy goal, the fact that that might go away as well could cast about 140,000 jobs into jeopardy. I do not think this is something we should do just lightly. And so this 28 per megawatt number comes from a study, and I think it was a bit ago. But the general idea is that that's installation jobs, it's manufacturing jobs, it's sales jobs, it's all sorts of other jobs that come with this. And since the 2030 solar energy goal is one that would apply to all different parts of the solar community, it would include all those types of jobs. And so I ask you all, whether it's 140 as we're estimating or even a little bit less, that's quite a bit of jobs to lose just effectively overnight. So I would ask you all to not accept this bill as it's been amended. And I think I'll make one last point, which is that the original bill was to make a requirement that allowed for carbon-free sources of energy to count towards the renewable energy standard. We make no statement at this time whether that itself is a good idea or not. I think it would make sense that perhaps if we're trying to eliminate climate change, that's a step in the right direction, so long as we expand the renewable energy standard in the process to accommodate for this. This particular amendment would actually sort of, I guess, run antithetical to that, in the sense that instead of expanding the renewable energy standard, it would effectively reduce it by 1.5%, and then it would eliminate the 10% goal. And so if the real intention behind this bill was originally to help reduce carbon, this bill does the exact opposite as it's been amended. So with that, I'll mention that I do have a member of our trade association that's come today to present, and he's here if the chair would allow him to speak.
Well, we'll take public testimony from whoever wants to talk. So are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Oh, so let's go with I'm sorry, Assistant Commissioner Grant, my apologies. We'll go with Assistant Commissioner Grant first and then. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant on behalf of the Department of Commerce, and thanks for the opportunity to provide brief testimony on House File 3003 as amended by the DE1 amendment. Department opposes House File 3003 in this form. As members know, the legislature adopted a 1.5% solar energy standard for our three investor-owned utilities in 2013. This bill would now exempt two of the three of those utilities from having to comply with less than 2 years to the 2020 compliance date, in spite of the fact that both have made significant strides toward compliance. In fact, Minnesota Power, in their most recent compliance report to the Public Utilities Commission, stated, quote, with proactive action in each pillar of the company's solar strategy, Minnesota Power is well positioned for compliance with its solar energy standard requirements in 2020. When the legislature adopts requirements like the solar energy standard, significant investment decisions are triggered, affecting actors large and small up and down a given supply chain. In this case, plans are in place with equipment manufacturers, installers, architects, and engineers are all potentially disrupted by a decision to terminate a requirement prematurely. This can result in lost jobs, lost investment in local communities, and foregone local property tax revenues. But perhaps the most troubling aspect of the DE1 amendment is the striking of the long-term goal to achieve 10% of the state's electricity from solar PV by 2030. While only aspirational, this language sends a powerful signal to stakeholders indicating Minnesota's preference for clean energy. Striking the language, though, sends an even louder message that policymakers' views on this are fickle and subject to politics of the moment. The department would strongly urge that this language be restored. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We'll proceed. You'll be around for questions.
Yes.
Thank you. The next testifier, please come forward. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Allen. I'm the CEO of All Energy Solar. Currently employ 120 people. We're based here in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're both an electrical and building contractor, focusing on small, medium, and large-scale solar projects throughout our seven state territories. The recent amendments proposed in House File 3003 by Representative Barr seem to undermine the importance of setting goals and standards for our clean energy economy here in Minnesota. Striking Minnesota Power's requirements as well as Otter Tail's requirements for a small-scale program not only takes away good-paying jobs for Minnesotans, but also sets the precedence that Minnesota legislators don't care to continue to build upon our growing solar industry that helps to ensure clean energy for years to come. Removing the solar renewable portfolio standard in Minnesota is a step in the wrong direction. I have to ask how you think this is a step in the right direction, other or any other direction than backwards. As a frame of reference, just yesterday, New Jersey passed an RPS of 50% by 2030. And today, Minnesota is proposing to remove our solar standard. I encourage the committee to not pass these adjustments and to come back to the table with proposals that look to holding our investor-owned utilities to the highest possible standards and to continuing making Minnesota the cleanest place to live and the cleanest air to breathe. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier, please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify. My name is Matt Pabratsky. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for Fresh Energy. We would just like to state the real value of broad standards, such as the solar energy standard, is that it sends a clear market signal to businesses in Minnesota and across the country that Minnesota is open for business. And since the solar energy standard and solar legislation passed in 2013, we've seen significant growth in both businesses and jobs in Minnesota, and we've also seen a corresponding drop in solar costs. And we would just mention that those falling costs industry-wide have helped schools, cities, families, businesses pursue solar in communities across the state. We would mention, of course, that the language that's being stricken regarding Otter Tail Power and Minnesota Power was actually negotiated at length last session, and it was done so with many stakeholders over the course of several months. So we would have concerns about that language being rolled back just 1 year later. So we would urge opposition to the bill as amended for those reasons. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier, please come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Director of Policy and Public Affairs at Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. For those of you unfamiliar with our organization, we are an industry-led nonprofit organization dedicated to strengthening Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. With that vision in mind, we look at this bill as what is it sending a signal to around the country. Minnesota is in range of grasping a lead on a competitive market, and investors from around the country are deciding where are we going to make our next investment. And they look at the solar energy standard as a predictable and stable policy that tells them that they have some security in their investments. So we would also oppose this bill, and we would say you can either look at these policies as mandates, or you can look at them as opportunities, and that's certainly what investors look at them as. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any additional members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Representative Barr, do you wish to respond before we go to member questions and comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I think I'll save my comments for a little bit later. Thank you.
I think there's been agreement from the testifiers that this bill would affect basically only Minnesota Power and Otter Tail Power. We're just going to nod at that. If someone could explain how this affects the Xcel service territory.
Mr. Chair, my name is David Schaefer with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. This bill affects all of the investor-owned utilities as it eliminates the 10% solar energy goal by 2030. So it's for all the utilities, all the IOUs.
Say that again.
So that it strikes the small-scale stuff, and it allows the Minnesota Power and Otter Tail to no longer be in the solar energy standard. But there's also a 10% by 2030 statewide goal that all of the investor-owned utilities are supposed to participate in, and it would strike that. So it affects all the investor-owned utilities.
So, Representative Barr, would you consider an amendment that would say that the goal of the state of Minnesota by 2030 to have 100% of our energy be clean and free?
Clean and free?
Yeah, 100%, all of it. All of it clean, all of it free.
Sure, let's go ahead. Then okay. Would that by 2030, we probably wouldn't be able to turn the lights on, but that's okay.
So, to the testifier, would that impact public policy and decision-making in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I may have misheard you. I think you said clean and free, so I assume you would prefer all the energy in the state of Minnesota to be free.
Well, it's a goal, so it's aspirational. So, of course, I would love to have the opportunity for my energy to be pollution-free and to be cost-free. It's an aspirational goal. I'm being semi-sarcastic, but I'm making a point that we've been told that goals are not binding public policy, but we seem to be hearing from the testifiers that a goal in statute that is a public policy, that it's more than aspirational, that it actually should be guiding decisions of the Public Utilities Commission and should be guiding lawmakers. So if that's the case, then the suggestion I made to Representative Barr that 100% of our energy be clean and free, and I don't know why we would wait until 2030. We could go for 2019. I mean, that would seems like that would be better for Minnesota then?
Mr. Chair, yes, I agree. If you would like to amend this, my understanding is from talking to the utilities, they tend to take goals fairly seriously, and I also don't like paying my energy bills. So if you'd like to make this amendment, that's fine with us.
I hate it when the testifier calls my bluff. Darn it. So, all right, thank you. So I would, in a serious note, I think you are correct that, I guess from an aspirational sense, the goal does stretch beyond Minnesota Power and Otter Tail Power. Is there someone from Minnesota Power here? You come down. Just some questions about how the solar mandate. I'll wait for you to come down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power.
Mr. Underdahl, can you explain just currently how the solar mandate applies to Minnesota Power right now?
Yes, happy to do that, Mr. Chair. So the solar standard applies uniformly to all utilities in that it's 1.5%. There's also an exemption process that applies to certain customers as defined by statute. That also applies to all utilities. However, some utilities, Minnesota Power, has a greater makeup in their customer base of those type of utilities, so we have a greater amount of exempted customers, so our numbers tend to be a little bit different than other utilities.
And Mr. Rundle, I think you may have misspoke. You said it applies to all utilities. I think you meant all investor-owned utilities.
Correct.
Above a certain
correct.
Size.
Correct, Mr.
So
Chair.
When you look at those categories, it's Xcel, Otter Tail Power, and Minnesota Power.
Correct.
Mr. Yelf, is there any other investor-owned utility that meets that category in Minnesota? Okay. So Mr. Underdahl, you said that in the current law, iron mining extraction processing facilities, they're laid out in statute. Approximately how much of your rate base is excluded from the solar mandate right now?
Mr. Chair, about 60-70% of our revenue comes from large power customers that would be exempted.
And when you say large power customers, does that mean the specifications that are currently listed
correct.
In statute is being excluded?
Correct.
Okay. So is it fair to say that right now the costs of the solar mandate are in Minnesota Power service territory are not being applied to the entities that are listed in statute as being excluded?
Mr. Chair, I'd say they're not being applied, nor are the benefits. And also, we therefore are only billing to that level. Right? So the amount we have to bill is relative to the non-exempt customers. We're billing less than we would if we billed to our total size.
So that cost and benefit that is being excluded from being borne by the iron mining industry, paper mills, wood products manufacturers, the elderly, senior citizens, families, do they bear the cost of it?
The costs that are applied through the solar energy standard and would be then paid by non-exempt customers. Correct, Mr. Chair.
And I believe you were here in 2013. Do you recall what the legislative rationale was for making sure that single parents and families bore this cost, but big businesses didn't?
Mr. Chair, I was not here in 2013, so I have an out. I 2014.
Lobbyists are answering the question. Okay. So the point is that right now, though, there's two different types of customers when it comes to the solar energy standard. In
determining the amount of solar required to build to meet the standard. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. In your recollection, in 2013, who had total control of Minnesota government when these exclusions were put in place?
Mr. Chair, that was the DFL party.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone from Otter Tail Power here? Tourette's. Okay. So, members, when I look at this bill, I see that right now the vast majority of Minnesota Power's service territory does not pay, in terms of the amount of kilowatt hours, megawatt hours, doesn't pay the solar mandate. And the reason why they don't pay for it is because the Democrats excluded them from the price of this cost. That's how that became law. It wasn't a Republican proposal. It came from the DFL. On top of that, the Otter Tail Power Service Territory, if they were to pick a part of Minnesota that has a lower solar footprint than any other part of the state, it's the Otter Tail Power Service Territory. They don't have to build solar panels in Minnesota or build solar farms in Minnesota to meet this standard. They can simply go out and buy solar RECs at pennies on the dollar for what it costs to build solar development in Minnesota. And so they're not here to validate this, but my understanding is the vast majority of Otter Tail Power's solar mandate is going to be met by them purchasing solar RECs from out of state, primarily southwestern United States where there's the greatest solar impact. So outside of the aspirational goal portions of this bill, what Representative Barr is doing is he's making sure that families in the Minnesota Power Service Territory have the same electricity benefits that high-intensive, energy-intensive businesses do. And in the Otter Tail Service Territory, the point is moot. They're going to be using solar RECs to meet the standard, not to develop new projects. So that's my opinion on that, and that's where we're at. But I'm happy to be corrected before we go to member questions. So first of all, I guess the question would be, can they meet the standard by just buying solar RECs from out of state?
Again, this is David Schaefer with Mencia, and Mr. Chair, could Otter Tail do that? Yes. Will they do that? I do not believe the answer to that is yes. And the reason why is they have a 30-megawatt project that they're soliciting bids on currently that should get them pretty much to the solar energy standard compliance, and that is supposed to be built, I think, next year. This is my understanding. Last summer they solicited those bids, and they might be asking for some more, but they've gotten some fairly good prices on that. As far as the small-scale stuff goes, last year our understanding was if Otter Tail was to get the change to the legislation that they sought and received, they would not buy RECs from out of state or elsewhere. They would attempt to build their own community solar gardens or at least look at doing that. And so I don't believe that their intention at that point, after the correction to the statute was made, that they intended to do this plan.
If only Otter Tail Power was here to clarify our comments, we would know. In the integrated resource plans that we have, any idea what the cost estimates of buying solar RECs are from out of state versus what it costs to install them? Do you have a range of pricing? Are they the same price? Is one cheaper than the other?
Mr. Chair, just so I understand, so this would be, if you were to build a REC, facility in Minnesota, the price of those RECs versus RECs elsewhere?
No, what would be the cost of building a project in Minnesota, say there's a range of costs for building solar energy in Minnesota versus if you were just to say, rather than build a project, we're just going to buy the solar RECs out of Arizona.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the price was $80 a megawatt hour. It's kind of the general ballpark of what they were looking at. I'm optimistic they can get much lower pricing than that. Then as far as RECs outside of state, if they wanted to, I think RECs are going from, like, a for solar RECs specifically, somewhere between, like, maybe $1.50 and $3 is kind of what I've heard quoted. But that's just what I've heard.
And you're making, that's a megawatt hour.
Megawatt hour.
Yeah. So about less than a half a cent a kilowatt hour.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So look, I've talked enough. We'll have questions from members of the committee. Representative Wagenius.
Yes. For Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Underdahl. If you could reintroduce yourself in the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for coming down. Minnesota Power ask for the law to be changed and ask for this amendment?
Mr. Underdahl.
Thanks for upgrade. Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we did not.
Representative Wagenius.
My next question, I guess, since we have established that Otter Tail is not here in the audience, Representative Barr, did Otter Tail Power ask to have the statute changed?
Barr.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, no. Representative or Otter Tail Power nor Minnesota Power, neither one asked me to change this statute.
Representative Wagenius.
Then did the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce ask you to change the statute?
Representative Barr, perhaps I could, did any professional entity, utility, business group, or anyone ask you to carry this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, no, this is kind of my own creation.
Okay.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I just want to establish specifically whether the Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, asked for the bill to be changed. And what I'm understanding, and I hope you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that Minnesota Chamber of Commerce did not ask for this change.
Representative Barr, you wish to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, no, the Chamber of Commerce did not ask specific. That was kind of the question, right? Was the Chamber specifically? No, they did not talk to the Chamber about this, or they did not ask.
Representative Wagenius.
And let me just ask, so did anybody ask you to author this change?
Representative Barr, anyone besides those paying the bills ask you to author this change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, no, this is my own creation. Nobody asked me to change this.
Representative Wagenius.
I think that's fine.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barr, thanks for bringing this forward. Don't go away, Mr. Underdahl.
You just might want to sit back there with everyone else. They kind of figured it out. So, Representative Fabian.
Well, Mr. Chair, first of all, I was here in 2013 when this was put into effect, and I can remember my friends on the Iron Range bringing this exemption forward for taconite and logging and so forth. And the reason that I remember that was given is that there's been a tremendous amount of boom and bust in those two industries. And at the time, I told them that, yes, I understand that, but you know something? There used to be, in 1979, there was about 2,000 people working at the Polaris plant in Roseau, Minnesota. And then the next year, there's 9 people working at the Polaris plant in Roseau, Minnesota. So, and I've also seen farming and agriculture, and the same thing happened in Arctic Cat and Thief River Falls with roughly the same number of employees. So I've seen the booms and busts in that industry. I've also seen the booms and the busts in agriculture. And when I was asking for an exclusion for the people that I represent, no, I couldn't get that. And you're right, Mr. Chair, this does fall onto single family or onto families. It falls onto schools and nursing homes and hospitals and clinics and so forth in rural Minnesota that are struggling with high energy costs. And I'm glad that this bill is here and that we're having the discussion. Mr. Underdahl, and oftentimes we're told not to ask questions that we don't know the answers to, but I know that Minnesota Power gets a substantial amount of their energy from renewable hydro. Where does that factor into your renewable portfolio?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, so we have about 120 megawatts of hydro on our system. That makes about 5% of our overall portfolio. In 2020, we'll be adding 250 megawatts of Manitoba hydro, which doesn't currently qualify under the renewable energy standard as it's currently in statute. It would if the underlying bill were to be enacted.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, members, and I was also here when the WAPA allocation was in controversy for Minn Kota Power and my rural electric cooperatives that got electricity from Garrison out in North Dakota. We weren't allowed to count that as renewable either. And we battled and we fought and we struggled, and we finally were able to get that small part of the WAPA allocation exempted from the renewable standard so that we were able to then... I'm sorry, the Western Power Allowance. It's a hydroelectric dam out in the Garrison, Lake Sakakawea. Generates a tremendous amount of electricity for much of rural Minnesota, northwestern Minnesota. And so if all this stuff is truly about clean and green and all that stuff, then let's be honest with each other and let's start counting all renewables, including hydro, as a renewable. Mr. Chair and members and people who are sitting here, you can go on your devices right now, and you can go to the North Star Electric Cooperative, and they have a real-time output of what's going on in their solar array that they have in Baudette, Minnesota. Okay? I know that they spent in the mid-$20,000 to put that solar array up, and these are good people who know what they're doing, but they wanted to put it up as a demonstration to show what the feasibility is of electric power. On there, members, you can go and look at the output. Okay, they spent what $24,000 putting this up, and last year they figured that they saved $399.63 by their current standards. Okay, so I'm going to ask you folks: you're going to go to the bank and you're going to tell your local banker you want to buy a car that's going to cost you roughly $24,000, Representative Vogel, and you're going to pay Representative Vogel's bank back $400 a year on that loan. And, oh, by the way, the car's not going to last as many years probably as what you're going to ask the loan to be for. I'm not opposed to renewables, okay? Don't get me wrong. I'm not opposed to solar. But these things, as we've heard from testifiers, are starting to gain a foothold in the economy because of improvements and so forth that are being made. I think that what Representative Barr is doing here and attempting to do here is admirable, and I support the bill and the amendment as it's been presented. So thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just did the math. You know I love math, Representative Fabian. And that's 60 years, a payback of 60 years. And since Mr. Underdahl is back, I was going to ask you a couple factual questions, numbers, and things like that. So have you figured out what your capacity factor and your efficiency is? So I know tell us what your capacity that you're putting in and what's the efficiency if you figured that out for the northern tip of Minnesota. And maybe you're not even putting them up there because the efficiency is so bad, but maybe you could just let us know what you know.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Representative O'Neill?
Pardon me?
So you're asking the capacity factor of the solar they're installing?
I'm asking the nameplate and then the capacity factor, right, and then the efficiency. So,
Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, for our total installed capacity needed to meet the 2020 requirement, it would be about 30 megawatts. And it is important to note, though, that you can bank renewable energy credits or solar renewable energy credits. So you might actually build an entire 30 megawatts. You could build it sooner, bank those racks, and they build up, and then you utilize them in the requirement year. So we'll have built, as proposed, we have built 10 megawatts, and we have another 10, 11 megawatts that's in the queue right now via our last integrated resource plan. Speaking to the exact capacity factor, I'm not going to allow to be able to be quoted on this. I'd have to check with our technical folks. I think it's in the neighborhood of 14 to 16%, but I'd want to check, and I'd maybe even defer to some of the solar energy professionals here. As far as the location of where we've placed our solar to date, it's typically been in the farthest southwest reaches of our service territory. So our first facility was down in Camp Ripley near Little Falls, and our following proposed facility will be generally in that same area, and that's where we typically have the best irradiation.
Is there any, the 14 to 16% factor for capacity factor for solar in Minnesota, is that generally agreed upon for fixed solar, or I see kind of hands waving, a little bit of fudge, but generally about right? Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I actually had a conversation with GRE, who has got a test facility, and they monitor every single thing, like Representative Fabian was just talking about. And the conversation I had with them, candidly, they had every type of panel that we sell and configuration, and they said the best capacity factor that they could get out of their test in Maple Grove was 11%. So it's probably, if we're going all the way up to Little Falls or something, I don't think it's quite that, because you lose, the further north you go, you're going to lose. You know, I've heard as much as 1% or 2% every time you're heading up towards Representative Fabian's district, which is probably why if they spent $24,000 and they're only getting back $400,000, and a 60-year return on that. That's probably why, because there's not a lot of solar resource up there. But
well, I think there's a couple of variables we're at play here, too. Number one, do you have solar panels that track, right? So if they're fixed versus tracking. And then if they are fixed, what's their orientation? Are they pointed towards the south? Are they pointed towards the west? Because there are tendencies where solar panels can be oriented towards the west, where they produce less energy, but the energy that's being created is more valuable. But so with regards to the capacity factor, I think that's why if people are wondering, why can't we just hammer down a specific answer on it, I think those are some of the factors that play into the variability of the numbers. But Representative O'Neill, did you have anything else?
You're not a nerd, right?
No, I'm not, yeah. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I was just trying to get at the fact that the solar resource in Minnesota is pretty terrible. If you look at the solar resource maps, I'd say I've looked at them for every month. And the only place that's really worse than, say, north of the I-94 corridor, which is essentially where they are, is Seattle, Washington, which is a rainforest. And so if you look at the month-to-month-to-month solar resource and the maps, you know, like how much solar is actually the resource there, it's pretty poor. There's not a lot of energy to be produced north of the I-94 corridor. So that was kind of what I was getting at, is that I'm not sure that this is the most efficient and effective way to use our resource dollars. As Representative Fabian just pointed out, $24,000 for a 60-year payback, I just don't think that's a very good use of resources.
Representative McGee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Since those who might be listening are going to assume that 60-year payback is the norm, I would like Mr. Allen to come down.
If you could, reintroduce yourself for the tape.
Can you help me with some payback numbers, please?
My name is Michael Allen. I'm the CEO of All Energy Solar. So the average payback for a residential solar system in Minnesota right now, including many systems that are on Minnesota Power's territory, is in the range of 7 to 12 years, depending on numerous factors that Chairman Garofalo mentioned.
Thank you.
I have a comment.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah. So, and I'm sorry, Representative Fabian?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I also have that same application. And this is actually, this is my home. It's pretty neat. Do you know how to understand what we're looking at here? I'm just curious.
Yeah, this is an application that's available, I think, for those who are interested. We could send out a link, but a lot of reporting data is available for individual solar arrays, not only in Minnesota, but other sites. The E-Gauge system, I think, is what it's referred to.
Yep. I'm very familiar with it. I think we have over 4,500 of these E-Gauge devices installed on people's homes, whether they have solar or not. And it's interesting to hear these numbers that you're representing. I'm not sure that those numbers are correct and that those numbers are accurately reading everything. I'm looking at my solar system, which cost me $30,000 to install. And I encourage everybody to understand all the economics before making some judgments on this. I assume that Representative O'Neill understands that there's a federal tax credit. that you get a 30% federal tax credit for installing solar. So if it's a $30,000 or $20,000 solar system, that the owner of that project would have also received a $6,000 federal tax credit, so bringing your cost down to $14,000. And then I'm really interested to understand what they're really monitoring with this app, because just running my numbers on my solar system here in St. Paul, my economics come to less than an 8-year payback. And that's average. That's pretty consistent across the line in Minnesota Power's territory. And I would encourage everybody here on the committee to ask some of Minnesota Power's folks that actually understand what's going on with SolarSense and how that program is run. If you have the opportunity, talk to Paul Hellstrom, who runs the SolarSense program for Minnesota Power. And I think he'd provide you some really interesting information that would maybe give you a little bit better understanding of how these programs work and what the economics really are.
You brought up your installation. Let's walk through the numbers on that so members of the committee can understand. So
sure.
It was a $30,000 installation.
Correct.
Presumably you got a $9,000 tax credit, 30%, which is, I like tax credits. I used the tax credit when I bought my car.
I'm sure, yeah.
So that brings it down to $21,000.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, we'll assume a... You said an 8-year. Which year payback should we use?
You could use 8 years, sure.
So $21,000 with a 8-year payback would be $2,625 of electricity being produced each year.
Yep.
And what would you put the estimated kilowatt hours usage of that? Like, what would you say the price of that? Like, how many kilowatts would it, in order to get to $2,625 of value?
Do you want to know energy or power?
Energy.
Okay, so kilowatt hours.
Yep. So how many kilowatt hours then would that require for your system to be producing on an annual basis?
So my solar system produces approximately 13 to 15,000 kilowatt hours a year.
Okay, so 15. So we take your 2,625.
Mm-hmm.
We divide that by 15,000 kilowatt hours.
Mm-hmm.
That means that you are pricing your electricity at 17.5 cents a kilowatt hour.
Actually, let's redo that math. So if we produce 15,000 kilowatt hours,
say it again.
15,000 kilowatt hours.
Yep.
Okay. We multiply that by 10 cents.
Okay.
Which you've got the calculator.
Yep. Well, that's easy math. That's the easy stuff. So it's $1,500.
Uh huh. Yeah. So let's also just do some quick math and let's understand what is the cost of electricity increase annually, Representative O'Neill.
So we'll build in a baseline assumption of 3 to 4%.
3 to 4%. I think, yeah, that would be, yeah. So we can figure that number out. And where does that land us at 8 years? I also have to, remember, do we have any type of incentives that the individual utility is providing? So if they're providing a 3 to 5 cent per kilowatt hour incentive or a 6 or 7 or 8 cent kilowatt hour incentive, we including that. So if we have a 10 cent kilowatt hour incentive, that also is giving me $1,500. So actually, my payback's better than 8 years.
Gotcha. And that is correct. That we're talking about price versus cost.
Yep.
So no doubt that in that situation, when you have other people around you paying for it, then yeah, your price is going to be lower. But there's a difference between price and cost. So when you mention the 8-year payback, you're correct. If you include other people picking up the cost of it, then yes. But I see those numbers.
I'm not sure where other people are picking up the cost of it.
Let the money for the solar incentive doesn't fall out of the sky.
Someone pays
for it.
It certainly doesn't. And we all pay for it. Yep. We all do with our renewable portfolio standards. Yep.
So just that whenever there's an incentive program, and again we use the term incentives or subsidize, when there's a cost shift, and we vote for cost shifts and against cost shifts all the time, when there's a cost shift, by definition someone else is paying for it. But I didn't mean to bombard you with questions. When you use the 8-year time frame, all my experiences have said that's not true, but you are correct if you include the incentive payments and you include the 30% tax credit and you include the implicit net metering subsidy.
Yeah, I would also encourage everyone to understand the other benefits that you receive as a business that owns a solar system as well. And many of you, I'm assuming, understand that you can depreciate an asset. And understanding depreciating that asset and the schedule that you can do that on. So on a commercial system, if we're talking about the same economics as my home, you'd probably be able to pay your system off in much less than 8 years. And these are all in tune with the tax plan that we're currently enjoying as that we're in right now with Section 179 and different 100% depreciation bonuses.
Sure. Representative McGinnis, you still have the floor for questions, so I just want to make sure before I go to the list.
It's not so much a question for the testifier. I appreciate what he said. I was going to make a comment that there is, of course, the benefit of reducing carbon, and this committee seems to wax and wane about whether we should be reducing carbon. Sometimes we laud it. Sometimes we laud it, and sometimes we pretend it's not a valuable goal. But I'm just going to talk a little bit politically right now, since I just came off of being endorsed in a convention where there were lots and lots of young people. And there were two issues that were on the minds of all young people. One was equity, and the other is climate change. I want to know what we're going to do, because they are living that future. It's not Representative Fabian and I that are living that future. It's young people. And they know that carbon is changing their future. So there is a benefit, besides the ones that Mr. Allen talked about, but we are not calculating in a carbon benefit, and I just put that on the table. Some will want to calculate it in, and some won't, but the young generation is almost to a person calculating it in, because they are going to live it.
So what's the benefit to expensively reducing carbon as opposed to cheaply reducing carbon?
I think they want all hands on deck, and you're taking one of the hands off the deck, or one of the things off the deck. And what's most interesting here is Minnesota does have solar. Minnesota does have wind. Minnesota does not have oil. Minnesota does not have coal. We are benefiting other states. We are exporting tons, billions of dollars for electricity to other states. Those dollars are not circulating in Minnesota. So that's how I would answer your question.
Okay, Mahoney, Dabney, then Fabian. Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've sat through this and listened to this, and, you know, I've spent my life building energy projects. And you are pretty quick, and Representative O'Neill and Representative Fabian are all pretty quick to take a shot at alternative energy projects and use dollar figures here and dollar figures there, and we're taking people's money and giving it to this particular group. You know, the solar industry, the wind industry, are pikers compared to the fossil fuel industry. They don't pay for their rigs anymore. We do. They don't pay for their pipelines. We do. And we do it through federal tax credits, federal tax deductions, and on our energy bills. So you can't sit here and use kilowatt hours versus this versus that and paybacks on just one industry. You need to, if you're going to tell the whole story, you need to tell the whole story about what fossil fuels, hydroelectric, because those are typically done with guaranteed federal loans, the tax rate on depreciation of oil rigs and oil pipelines and equipment that services those particular things. Frankly, we as a nation have made a decision that we want plentiful, cheap energy. And we want it from every particular source. So to sit here and complain about one requirement or another, or solar mandate or another, versus the cost of it, if we're going to make good policy decisions, you need to have the whole thing here, and you need to put into play all particular types of energy and who's paying for it. So I think we're having a relatively false argument, or at least a half of an argument. And until we bring in the tax people that will tell us exactly what fossil fuel industry gets in their tax breaks. This is kind of a muted point, and we're just playing nerd on a committee's time. So I'm frustrated with that particular piece. I don't love solar. I think our, from what I'm seeing, the wind industry would be a much better place for us to invest our state money. But we've made a choice that we're going to do solar. So unless you have a bill here to remove all the solar tax breaks and everything else, we're passing a lot of hot air across people's heads.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to ask Mr. Evans to come down, but if we're going to be doing dollars and cents and pennies, nickels, and quarters, Xcel went to do some work on their nuclear plants, and the cost overrun on those nuclear plants was somewhere in the area of hundreds of millions of dollars.
But that was different.
Not 10 cents or 15 cents, but hundreds of millions of dollars. And then rather than looking them square in the eye and saying, you screwed up, you eat it so that you don't screw up again, our friends at the PUC said, pass it along to the ratepayers. So if we're going to get out the calculators, let's put the cost overruns on nuclear plants in the calculations as well. Let's put the cleanup work on coal plants in there as well. And we could go on, but that's not a bad couple of factors to add back in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do think that to Representative Dabney's point on the cleaning up of the coal plants, I assume you're talking about scrubbers and so forth. That's passed on to the ratepayers in my district. So I'm listening to the conversation here, Mr. Chair, and I've got two comments that I'd like to make. First of all, I'm hearing from some of the testifiers that under the current incentives that are available, that according to the numbers that they're using, that this is working. Why do we need the incentive? Why do we need the government to come in and say you must do something else? It's by your testimony, your plan is working with the current incentives. And
Hold on. Representative, stay in.
Excuse me. So anyway, I'm sure that this discussion is going to go on for a long time. Mr. Underdahl, I wish Mr. Atkinson was here. There's a transmission line that's coming across the Canadian-Manitoba border into Minnesota, currently in Roseau County. And what's the name of that transmission line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, it is called the Great Northern Transmission Line.
Thank you. And where is the power coming from?
Representative Underdahl. Mr. Underdahl.
Yeah. I'm going to get there. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that power will be coming from Manitoba Hydro in Manitoba Province.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Underdahl, where is that power going to?
Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that will be serving the Minnesota Power Service Territory in northeastern Minnesota.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Underdahl, roughly how many miles across the state of Minnesota is that power line traversing?
Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we serve an approximately 26,000 square mile service area.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And the length of the line?
Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, the line will be approximately 220 miles.
Thank you. Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I just want the people to know this, too. I go home almost every weekend, including this weekend if I get out here before the storm comes. But I had a good friend of mine who's a former student of mine, and he works for a construction company in Roseau. I suppose I could put in a shameless plug for Stauskopf Ready Mix, but I'm not going to do that. and he told me, he said, hey, Dan, do you realize what they're doing on the power line in terms of construction? And I said, no, what do you mean? He said, they're starting to dig the holes to put the towers up. Okay? He said, you know what we have to do with the spoil, which is the dirt that's in the ground? We have to haul it off site. We can't spread it in a real thin layer someplace in the existing area. We have to haul it off site. It's adding tremendous cost. He said, hey, I'm making lots of money on my contract, but that's what we are required to do with the permit that's been issued. And, oh, by the way, he said, when we make the holes and water seeps into them, water from the ground, Representative Wagenius, groundwater.
Probably.
You know what they have to do with that water? They can't pump it out of the hole and shoot it into the woods, you know, 50 yards away. They have to haul it off-site, adding tremendous costs again. Members and people, we are adding costs to electricity that I think are unnecessary. And when we talk about environmental review and permitting and streamlining, is it any wonder why I get a little passionate about it once in a while? And I know that we're not going to change the situation on the Great Northern Transmission Line, but this is quite astounding as far as I'm concerned. I just wanted to make that comment because the power line goes through my district, and it's a valuable piece. I've been up there. I've seen the deer walking across it, and it's a cool place. It's going to be wide open territory. So,
Representative Mahoney. Oh, sorry, Representative Mahoney.
Well, you know, seeing how we're all wasting time here, I'll tell the story about my backyard, which I made the mistake of putting in a slate sidewalk, and because the water that comes off of my my garage, and I've tried to divert it, but doesn't quite get to where I want it to go, every summer I have to dig up that slate sidewalk and raise it up because the water that stays in right there where I put it continues to lower the because of the weight of the slate sidewalk, sinks into the ground. Now, I'm not sure if that relates back to power lines and what we require water to be taken away, but I sure would not want to have a transmission tower at a, well, I don't know, 87% angle or 70% angle. So maybe there's an engineer that could give a better explanation of that common sense than a FIED teacher.
All right, so we have gone a little bit off of topic here, and we'll come back to it. I want to thank Representative Barr for having this conversation. I'm going to give you the closing word, Representative Barr. But, you know, not all of us, not everyone was here in 2013 when the solar mandate was passed and is aware of the legislative history of what was originally proposed, what was excluded, what was all that entire process. And it's a good thing for the committee to understand this and the trade-offs that were made then. And as we, you know, part of our job is to revisit policy as we go forward. So we haven't had an extensive dive on this issue, and I thought it was a I want to thank you, Representative Barr, for introducing this bill so we can have a conversation about that. But Representative Barr, as the chief author, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In your packets, you'll notice there was a letter from the Sierra Club, and in the next to last paragraph in there, the Sierra Club believed that this bill would not have an overall effect, pro or con, whether any solar voltaic panels were installed on homes or the small solar. Some of the other things that we've gone through here, where we're talking about some of the tax crediting for the different solar pieces that we're talking about here, this really only makes economic sense when you factor in the net metering, income tax credits, purchase credits, power credits, et cetera, et cetera. Then it becomes quasi-cost effective. And I would like to equate that to Paul Anderson left, but Representative Anderson. But to the farmers in around here, they are right now dealing with ethanol subsidies that are being cut off the federal government, which is making ethanol extremely expensive. So when we as a body put all of these credits in place to incentivize people to come out and start businesses and employ people to do something that is not cost-effective on its own is actually setting them up to fail at some point in the future. Do I think that solar is a viable resource? Yeah, if I lived in Death Valley, someplace where the sun shines 330 days out of the year, and I'm not this far north on the latitudinal lines, it makes a little more sense, just like wind doesn't make a lot of sense someplace where the wind doesn't blow, but it does blow here, which is why wind is actually getting to be the cheapest cheapest source of energy that we all use in a renewable form as opposed to solar. So, yes, I think we should, if we're going to be pushing some kind of a carbon-free energy, it should be the wind as opposed to solar, because the wind is down, if my memory is half correct here, is about $22 a kilowatt hour. Megawatt hour. So 22 a megawatt hour as opposed to some of the other things that we've got. And but when you factor in all of take all the subsidies out of here, solar just doesn't quite come anywhere close. They're somewhere around 140 megawatt hour. So it's probably the most expensive energy we have here. And if we're going to talk about lowering the cost for consumers, we should be promoting the wind as opposed to the solar, which is why the solar is the only piece that's affected in this bill. And then we should not be setting up these fine people behind us that actually install small solar to fail with all these tax credits. And with that, I ask for the bill to be laid over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barr, and thank you, members, for the conversation. Representative Clark? Representative Clark moves House File 3865 for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mine went on all the time.
This is the smaller version.
That's 45 minutes from there.
Mr. Chairman,
if we got rid of all of them, you would have more oil industry people in here. If you call that fun, good. I would not.
That's true.
But I don't think I want to see the aspirants for $4.
Very
short. You know, one way I don't see it, the other side. The other way I see it.
If people could take their conversations into the hallway, please. Lobbyists and as such. So, Representative Clark, do you have an amendment to your bill, Representative Clark?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Maybe, and the nurse in me says, everybody take a really deep breath. and then let's go ahead.
So, Representative Clark, the DE1 amendment yours?
Yeah, House File 3865, I'd like to ask to amend it with the DE1 amendment, please.
So, Representative Clark moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill the form she would like. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. 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 Say nay. Motion prevails. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm really happy to bring this bill before you. It's called the East Phillips Neighborhood Institute. We're really talking here about a bill that you all helped us with last year. We got a beginning on establishing an indoor urban farm in the part of the city of Minneapolis in my neighborhood, where we have a lot of issues going on with health concerns and so on, low income families for the most part struggling to have jobs, and we have a disproportionate share of some of the environmentally induced illnesses that are reported by our state. So we, in the community, the neighborhood, took the funding that was made available to us last year from this committee and did a lot of work on looking at planning and designing a project that I want to talk with you about more today, and we come back today to ask the committee to invest more deeply in this project. And I'm going to turn it over to mostly the people in the neighborhood. They've done a lot of work on this over the last, actually it's been a four-year project, and today we're back asking for money to actually do some of the construction and go forward with the project. I want to just take a few minutes right now to thank all of those who've been involved. Some of them are sitting here behind me. A couple of people couldn't come today, but I'm going to start with Mr. Dean DeBolis, who is our architect, who's done a lot of the work on preparing the groundwork for what we need can go forward with the construction. And I think you have some charts with you that we can show. Okay.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Dean DeVolis, DJ Architecture. I think the cupcakes are a good idea. So I'll work out. I've learned from this, so whenever I have a heated meeting, I'll bring some along. So thank you. So what I'm going to do is just give a quick oversight of the project, why we're here and so forth. And I want to give credit where credit is due on this endeavor. This is really the genius of the neighborhood has pulled this together and have really contributed to make this happen. And the group that's sitting behind us, and I'm going to ask a few of them actually to step up after me, because that's really the heart of how this project has come together and really the genius that's behind it. So quick background, and it may be in your packet, maybe not. Essentially what we are doing of the public work site, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Of the public work site in the city of Minneapolis, which is a 16-acre parcel, we're working with the city to take the most southern 3 acres and develop an urban farm in this location, which is actually a very positive location for this endeavor for a bunch of reasons. But I take the economics, we're locating it where all the major food users are in the city of Minneapolis, because when you think of downtown, the hospitals, the university system, school system, so forth, in South Salem location, the city of Minneapolis was open to allow us to locate in this area that you see in the southern portion of this. So that has given us the opportunity to make this project a reality, and that's what I've been working with in putting this together. The project will really consist of two portions, and it's going to consist of a low-tech portion using an existing building on the site, formerly known as the Roof Depot building, which will be about 45,000 square feet. That'll contain what we call the low-tech portion of indoor urban farming, ones that don't require the highly sophisticated sealed indoor environment for crop production. We have several companies interested in low-tech company have come forward already. The other side of the site, which is you see over here, is going to be the high-tech portion. That'll be new construction. That'll be more of a high-bay structure. That'll be more sealed. That is more commercial, technological production of food and aquaponics. We have a company that has come forward, and a member of that company is here with us that wants to take that portion. That's another 45,000 square feet. In addition, on the roof, we are going to provide solar power, which I was well intrigued by the conversation just passed, and also structural so we can contain affordable housing on it. So the idea that we're going to make these buildings do a lot of work besides just the food production to really provide affordable housing for communities will be funded by other sources and energy and, of course, the job creation. The beauty of indoor agricultural farming is that it allows everyone to participate. It's not like a high-tech industry, which coding after a degree, people can step into it right away because of an innate ability to grow, or people in the high-tech knowledge can grow into it. And there's a lot of connections that reach in the community. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to allow if you want to ask any questions concerning the building. If not, I'll let community members come forward to describe their role in this process. And so thank you.
And just for those of us who are not familiar with the area, I know the blue line runs right by there.
Correct.
Is the stop right on 28th?
The stop is actually at Lake Street, which is just a quarter mile to the south. So it's within the transit walking, and that's another big positive aspect of this location.
And then what's the stop north of the Lake Street stop?
It's the Franklin stop.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. And Representative Clark, how much time did you need for testimony?
Well, I know that we've all been here a long time, but could we have like another 10 minutes?
Sure.
Everybody could.
So we'll go till 1:15 for public testimony. So just meter out the public testimony.
So what I'll ask for now, okay, I'm just going to. So what I was going to say is I'll have a couple, and remember, I was going to have someone from what I call the low tech portion of it, and someone from the high tech portion. So I'll start with the high tech portion first. So Clarence, could you please come forward and just give a brief description of your company and endeavors? Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Clarence Bischoff, and I'm with the Minnesota Sustainable Development Group. Our company, the Minnesota Sustainable Development Group, is developing the high-tech park of the urban farm that we're talking about today. Minnesota Sustainable Development Group is a company made up of about 45 people. It represents a whole spectrum of different kinds of skills, including we have scientists and engineers, financial experts, marketing people, to help create that what we refer to as a local sustainable food system. At East Phillips, we are planning to develop a 80,000 square foot facility. This facility would be very similar to regional models. In St. Paul, we have Urban Organics, and in Wisconsin, in Northfield, Wisconsin, there's a company with the same model called Superior Fresh. With East Phillips, our products would be a little different. We're very excited about the fact that we do have the research needed to raise fish, and the species that we've chosen is walleye, which we think is probably one of the best fish products that one could want, and also the Minnesota fish. The and then we're somewhat unique, too, in terms of the horticultural products, because we're looking at fruits and vegetables, and we want to go beyond the greens, most often in the aquaponic facilities, it's mainly lettuce, but we are going beyond that to raise cherry tomatoes and peppers, all the ingredients for a packaged salad. That'll be on one level. And another level, approximately 1 acre of strawberries. To market these products, we're following the Cleveland model, which starts with the connection with anchor institutions, and very, very pleased with the connection we've made with the Minneapolis Public School System. They are very interested in buying our products, and beyond that, there's a possibility they would use our facility for training purposes, and that we would, in addition, work with the school in setting up a Minneapolis school system farmstead with maybe different locations, but using the growing of food for teaching science and nutrition and good health and all the rest of it. So that's in process as well. So in addition to working with the anchor institutions, we would also have online sales and direct to the consumer sales. The overall, on the financial side, it looks as though it's a huge project and complex. We could talk for a long time, but it looks good. We will be able to probably provide employment for up to 40 people, and in addition to that, I think we'll achieve about $8 million in sales. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Would the next testifier please come forward?
Yeah.
And we got about 6 minutes left, Representative Clark.
I know. We'll try to be brief, and I just wanted you to get a little taste of some of the folks that are working on this. It's an amazing
Absolutely.
Group of folks.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Cassandra Holmes. I'm a resident at Little Earth of United Tribes, and thank you guys for listening to us today. The Little Earth is partnering with this because, well, of course, it's like right next to our community, and you know, it has to do with our food desert there in our community and in Little Earth, and even our surrounding community of East Phillips, the environmental injustices and stuff. So we really would like to see from Little Earth is that we would like to see a lot of like more education, jobs, green, second chances at just everything that this is going to allow for our community. And Little Earth would be partnering because we have a piece of land in the back of Ogama that would be kind of like a stepping stool, and it would be like hands-on training and gardening and everything that has to do with this project. And we'd be a stepping stool to the stepping stool to the like low-end and high-end aquaponics that they plan to have there. So it would really be, it's a really hopeful situation for us at Little Earth and for our community in East Phillips, and we are really excited about it and hopes that we can see our dreams here come true. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
And my name is Ava, and hello, everybody. I am a Phillips neighborhood resident, have been since 1998. I am also a mother of five and have been running a program that works with the East African youth, mostly from Phillips and the area, however, not limited to. So I've been working with East African youth and young adults who have homelessness, chemical dependency, mental illness, many other challenges. Before I get to that, if I kind of like quickly talk about East African, I'm sorry, Phillips neighborhood. Moving in, and I'm a homeowner in Phillips neighborhood, our neighborhood have been suffering a lot of challenges ever since I've moved to that, ever since I have became a resident, and most likely before. This is the first time I have heard a resource that will be available for our community, mm-hmm. a resource that will be helpful for those who are from Phillips and even in the area. We are a neighborhood that have that suffers with unemployment, homelessness, lack of housing for many of the multicultural communities. We have a community that helps many immigrants when they first start and come into our state. And I'm really glad and grateful of Karen and everybody else who have been behind of this project, which will be a resource for our youth to restart, to allow them to have some training programs, to have them possible housings if we were able to get the land that we're looking for. Unlike Little Earth, there are many other communities that live in Phillips who don't have land of their own. And so finding a peace, getting a acceptance from the city of also Minneapolis, which we are not here for today, I guess, will be giving a chance for many of the other communities that are suffering and part of the neighborhood. Thank you, and with that, I will pass.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, we have other folks, and I think we'll let them, I'll just mention their names. Folks, a couple couldn't be here, Jose Luis Villasenor, who's with Tamales y Bicicletas, which is a bicycle shop that will be there. We have a person who's been very involved in the low-tech aquaponics, Chad Hubert, who can't speak. Who isn't here, and Steve Sandberg. I'm not going to ask him to speak just in interest of time, but he's been working with something called the Phillips World Cafe, which is an employment opportunity for youth of all cultures. I'm going to end, Mr. Chairman, by just saying yesterday we got the green light from the Intergovernmental Relations Department of our city to go forward with this bill here today, and my city council member was going to be here. The time situation didn't work out for Council Member Cano to come, but she wanted me to let you know that she's, you know, strongly supporting this, and as are a majority of the city council members. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stop right there because I know people do want to get going and get away, home before the snowstorm happens, but I'm happy to entertain any questions. I just want to say that it's the investment we're asking for here really builds on the investment that you all helped us get last year, and we're really proud of it, and I think we're going to do some very good work.
Well, thank you, Representative Clark. Is there any closing comments or questions from members of the committee? Thank you, Representative Clark. Thank you, members of the committee. A couple of quick announcements.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to lay this bill over for?
Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Clark renews her motion. House file
3865.
You made the motion as amended, laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Everyone, first of all, please drive safe given the weather conditions this weekend. Stay tuned to your email for a schedule for next week of the rollout of the omnibus bill. I'll be in touch with staff as well as with Representative Mahoney on the scheduling for that. Is there any questions at all? Have a great weekend, everyone. With that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, drive safe, everyone.